$2.6 million last year through the first round to support our care coordination and medical home activities. However, our current application goes beyond what we're doing in Medicaid. And Medicaid in Minnesota is medical assistance. So when I use the term Medicaid, it's the same as medical assistance, for those of you who may not be familiar with our terminology. This grant seeks to support in creating a public-private collaborative to facilitate the transformation of the healthcare system. We believe that this collaborative approach is what is necessary to markedly improve quality and manage costs of our public programs. We cannot make this transformation happen by ourselves. We won't even want to try to do that. We believe we have to do this in conjunction not only with other public purchasers, but with the private sector. Fortunately, we're well positioned in the state to make this happen, given the various initiatives and collaborative efforts already underway. More specifically, we are asking CMS for funds on behalf of a multi-stakeholder alliance to develop organizational and system support to further these efforts. These efforts include, one, the transparency of quality and price information, two, common measurement and public reporting of clinical outcomes, three, the development of provider and patient incentives, and four, the electronic exchange of clinical and administrative information. Now, there's other things that we need to do as well. We're not saying that that's going to be sufficient in order to transform healthcare system, but we do believe that these kind of activities need to be supported. And so we need to develop the infrastructure, capacity, support these critical efforts going on in the community today. This is about making information more readily and securely available to consumers, providers, and payers, all of whom play an important role in increasing the value of healthcare as measured by quality, cost, and access. These funds will be used to form what's called a value exchange. This is a term that's been coined by the Federal Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, which is part of the Department of Health and Human Services, to support their value-driven healthcare agenda. You may have heard about the four cornerstones of Secretary Leavitt's agenda to improve healthcare. And their four cornerstones are very similar to what we're trying to develop here in Minnesota. And the agency intends to charter these value exchanges throughout the country. In fact, yesterday was the deadline for comments to the Federal Register notice as to how they're going to go about doing this chartering. We expect a decision from CMS by the end of September as to whether or not we will receive these funds. At this stage, it is difficult, if not impossible, to predict savings that will result from this. I know that's what your focus is. I wish I had some specific numbers. But what the result of all this is going to be eliminate unnecessary and ineffective care, to reduce medical errors, and to improve health status. These are the desired results of this effort. Now, part of the resources that we're asking for, however, is to do a business model or a business case around these initiatives, including the calculation of savings. We believe that we have to develop that capacity to calculate the, if you will, the return on investment is another way of looking at this. If we're going to be doing these things, exactly what are the savings that we need to, not only, of course, cost savings, but what kind of improvement in quality are we going to achieve through this, through these activities? So we will be doing that as part of our grant activity. Now, let me turn to a graph that you have. It's titled MinHive Project Overview. This is Minnesota Health Information Value Exchange Project Overview. What I'm going to do is take you through, especially the left-hand side. These four boxes in the left-hand side of the graph are the four cornerstones that the Department of Health and Human Services have laid out in terms of their value-driven healthcare agenda. And it gives you an idea of some of the activities that are going on within Minnesota that relate to these four cornerstones. Now, in terms of the health IT area, this involves developing a secure electronic infrastructure for sharing information, both clinical and administrative, available statewide to all providers and payers. Not a new idea at all. This has been done and tried in other places, and certainly in other areas of the country that are more advanced than we are today on this. There's broad agreement that we need better information sharing, impossible task for any individual entity to pull off on its own. This would not be creating a data warehouse or repository, but developing an information highway where clinical information is exchanged in a secure and as-needed basis. Now, a lot of this work, of course, has been done already by the eHealth Advisory Committee, and you've perhaps have heard from that committee in terms of that of the eHealth initiatives that we've undertaken through the Department of Health area. This would also maintain and protect consumers' right to privacy, accommodating a person's right of consent. Now, we believe that providers under this arrangement can deliver better care if they can access a patient's medical history at the time they need it. For example, in emergency rooms, or urgent care, or retail-based clinics. Also, when someone enters a nursing home to get medication history transferred over to the nursing home so that there is a smooth transition of health care. And better information will translate into fewer medical and pharmacy errors and reduced inpatient admissions from ER visits. The next two boxes lay out the activities that we have around transparency of quality and price. This proposal supports public reporting of providers' performance, good and bad. The foundation is being laid already in Minnesota through initiatives such as the Minnesota Community Measurement, Minnesota Nursing Home Report Card, and other activities, public reporting activities. This proposal also supports quality improvement initiatives, such as being undertaken by the Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement and Stratus Health. Stratus Health is the Medicare Quality Improvement Organization. This kind of information will be critical to their efforts to improve quality. Transparency of price and quality is needed to support consumers' ability to effectively purchase healthcare services and to shine light on the quality of care provided in our healthcare system. Also needed to educate consumers about what options may be available at different prices. For example, our Minnesota RX Price Compare website educates consumers about generic versus brand name medications and the value of looking towards generic substitution. As consumers look at the price and quality of healthcare, they will gravitate towards the best value. As consumers demand for better value increases, we will see better value, we're convinced. The last box relates to incentives. This is reward providers and patients who achieve optimal health care. Examples of this are Bridges to Excellence, which I'm sure you've heard about in terms of the effort by employers that we've also joined to develop incentives for providers that provide optimal health care. Also, our Q Care initiative, which, for example, this past year we put in place into our managed care contracts incentives for managed care organizations to achieve the objectives under acute care around preventive screening. And also the legislature this past year enacted the program for medical assistance patient incentives. They'll go into place in the next year or two whereby for those patients who also achieve that optimal health care, they will be given a reward in terms of a financial incentive. Now those are the four critical cornerstones that this effort would support. Now, as we introduced this back in June, we first thought that maybe we needed to form one entity to do this, but we're not necessarily there at this point. We believe that this could be done through a combination of current entities or perhaps developing a new organization to support some aspects of this effort. So when we talk about a value exchange, we're not necessarily talking about a single entity doing all this. We believe that the value exchange, though, is going to be the coming together of these activities to coordinate our efforts to transform healthcare. And we mentioned on the right-hand side, right-hand corner, bottom corner, what we believe the benefits to Medicaid will be, as well as to the system-wide benefits. And again, on benefits to Medicaid, we believe this will improve the quality of care in terms of fewer errors and less duplication of care. Transparency of quality and cost fosters purchasing strategies based on value, such as we've starting to do with our managed care organizations and hope to do with our fee-for-service providers. And also, we will eventually see administrative savings through this, we're convinced, especially because of the administrative uniformity work that was enacted by the legislature this past year and is being managed through the health department as we speak. And in terms of system-wide benefits, clinical information is available to providers at the point of care. It will be uniform and transparent measurement and reporting of cost and quality to advance the value-driven health care, and care is better coordinated across the system and quality and value will improve. Now, this builds on things that we're already involved in terms of our medical home activities and our care coordination activities. We believe that, and if we're successful in getting this grant, we believe that this can be the catalyst financially to develop these efforts. Now, it's not clear. I'm optimistic that we're going to get some of this $11.6 million that we asked for, but it's not clear at this point whether or not it's going to take place. But notwithstanding that grant and whether or not we receive funds, we need to undertake this activity. There's already discussions with various organizations as to how to advance this. The Minnesota Community Measurement Organization is already somewhat of a value exchange. They already, as you know, collect and analyze and report information on quality. It's already the beginning of the value exchange. And when the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality talked about this value exchange, they were given examples like the Minnesota Community Measurement. So we're further along, we believe, than other parts of the country around this, and we believe that we'll be well positioned. Now, whether or not we'll actually charter a value exchange through the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality remains to be seen. We'll find out what exactly the value of that will be. So far, our sense is the value is that we'll have access to Medicare data, which is very important, and that also we'll be part of a learning network. We'll be part of other chartered value exchanges in the country to learn how they're going about doing this. But the focus should not be on the entity itself, the value exchange itself. The focus should be on what kind of critical functions and activities and organizations are we going to coordinate through this. So though we've said in our proposal that we're going to talk about one nonprofit entity, we're not suggesting that necessarily will be the end result of this. Mr. Chairman, I'll be glad to answer any questions that you or the committee members may have about this proposal.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner Osberg, so how would this grant, if we receive it, fit in with the $14 million in e-health grants that the legislature appropriated this last year?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, these grants would support our ability to form the overall arching activity and organization to support various things, including electronic health record development. Electronic health record grants that went to the health department to be issued to rural and safety providers is to support their ability to develop electronic health record capacity in order to meet, of course, the requirement that we're putting in front of providers to have EHR by year 2015. That is to support a specific provider for a specific task, and that's electronic health record. Now, to tie all that activity together, EHR activity together, with the transparency activity, with the public reporting activity, and with the incentives, provider and patient incentives development, that's what this is trying to do, is tie those critical components together to make sure that it's in sync. And so that's a separate, more specific set of financing for rural and safety providers.
Senator Berglund.
So, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, this would allow anyone who received a grant from the Department of Health to all be interconnected with anyone who has an e-health record system?
Mr. Chairman, Madam Senator Berglund, yes, this would help connect the ability for those who have EHRs to talk to others. What's happening is that there are some major investments are taking place, especially by the large systems, around electronic health record development. Now, it's the small providers, they're struggling as to how to finance that, and that's where the legislature, at the request of the governor, stepped in and said that we need to make that happen, and that's what we're doing. Now, the question is, after the organizations have electronic health record capacity, how do they speak to each other? And this is exactly what we hope to do. I'll give you an example. It just happened this past few weeks is that down in southeastern Minnesota, Rushford Clinic was completely destroyed by the flood, and their paper records were destroyed. But they fortunately had an electronic health record connected to the Winona Clinic. So they're able to transmit information over to Winona Clinic to serve those patients at Rushford. It gives you an idea as to the value of electronic health record. Now, the question is, how can all these various EHRs talk to each other? Well, that's what we need to make sure happens next. That's the next logical step and all the eHealth work we're doing is to make sure that it's called interoperable exchange of information amongst the various providers.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, thank you. You don't need to convince me about the value of eHealth records.
Mr. Chairman, that
I'm
I know.
I'm glad that this is one of the areas the governor and I agree on.
Yes.
And I'm thrilled to hear that we're applying for a grant that might give us interoperability statewide, because that's the thing that we really have charged the Department of Health with that task of getting everything to become interoperable. And one of the reasons I wanted this group to understand about this is because I see this tool as being a building block for other things that we might be doing in the future in regard to cost containment. If we get the grant, if we get the value exchange, there are other things that are being discussed that could fit into this, I think.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, again, we're already having discussions with various organizations as to how we can pull this off. We're not necessarily waiting for the grant to happen for us to think about how can we do this. And so, but it certainly would help to receive the kind of support from CMS.
Are there other questions? Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Brian, could you just explain a little bit more about how it relates to the organizations that are actually doing the operations of that work now? I think you and I have talked about the fact that community measurement is actually a value exchange and that it has the ability to get Medicare aggregate data from CMS. And so they're already down the pike quite a ways on being a value exchange. But you had mentioned that the state had more interest in engaging with community measurement. Could you just say more about that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Again, as I mentioned, since we're pretty far along already in terms of some of these key components as to public reporting and community measurement and around quality indicators, what we anticipate is that we need to build on that. We need to build on that to also have more involvement from other sectors as well, public sector involvement, for example. But also we need to build on that to make sure that there's a place for consumers to go to get information so they can be more prudent purchasers of healthcare. And so I think if you talk to the Minnesota Community Measurement and other efforts, I think we have a good start, but we need to go further with this. So we don't want to reinvent anything. That's what's real important here, is we don't want to reinvent and necessarily develop a lot of other new activities, because a lot of good things are going on already. The key is how do you tie those activities together in some fashion? That's what we're trying to accomplish with this. And so I think what's been talked about is that Minnesota Community Measurement or something like that could be what we call a value exchange plus. We're going beyond, even beyond what we think the federal government is thinking about or looking for as well. Because whatever we do has to be done in conjunction with foremost within Minnesota. We work with other Medicaid agencies, for example, in terms of health insurance ideas, health information ideas, and things of that sort. But we really believe it's critical that we work with the private sector more than anybody in Minnesota to develop a Minnesota solution to all of this. And that's what we want to do, is continue to partner and collaborate with the private sector to develop the capacity that goes beyond what we are today, but to build on where we are today.
Doctor.
Mr. Chairman, yes, no, indeed, we are interested in that. We've been following that very closely, and we've had discussions with those involved in those efforts, the ARC-funded effort as well as other efforts. And so we're very interested in looking at how we could potentially be a partner around some of this. Of course, this kind of funding would help us position ourselves more effectively in those kind of arrangements. But still, we believe that we need to be at the table. We're very much involved, for example, with aligning forces for quality arrangement that's being managed through Minnesota Community Measurement. We're at the table for that. We get involved in the best BQI effort that MCM has with Minnesota Community Measurement has with the federal government. And we're following closely. We serve on the e-health steering committee, for example, and we're following closely those activities and trying to determine where we best fit. And we're very interested in being at the table and very interested in being a partner around those activities.
Representative Huntley.
Commissioner Asperger, I don't want to get into a bureaucratic fight, but many of these things on this list are things that have previously been run out of the Department of Health. And I certainly understand why Department of Human Services, which spends about $5 billion a year on health care, is interested in improving health care. But how are you going to integrate this with the Department of Health and the things they're already doing in this area?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, yes, we certainly have ongoing discussions and meetings with the Department of Health about how best to coordinate all of this. We are at, they're developing and implementing the administrative uniformity piece, for example. We're involved in that very much as a payer, and it's also as a provider at Department of Human Services. As I said, we serve on the e-health steering committees, so we, as in representing state purchasers' perspective on that e-health work, we're very much we're involved in the Minnesota Public Health Information Network. At every step of the way, we have a coordination with the Department of Health as to how best to do this. And as to where things lie in terms of implementation over time, that remains to be seen. I don't think anybody has a specific vision as to what exactly be placed where. As long as these things come together in some coordinated fashion, we're not concerned about turf, certainly, about how this is done. We're involved in this only because we're the Medicaid agency, and the Medicaid agency is the only one that can apply for this kind of opportunity, the Medicaid Transformation Grant. That's why we're here talking about this today. It's because we have to demonstrate to the federal government how Medicaid would benefit from this larger effort. And we've been encouraged by the federal government for Medicaid to coordinate our work with the health department around e-health and with the private sector. So it is a matter of making sure that this is done well and effectively. And so we have ongoing discussions with the department, certainly.
Ms. Brock.
If you're going to enter this arena as the agency that's taking care of the Medicaid patients, would you consider entering that arena carrying with you some of the issues that are particular to Medicaid patients rather than just being another of all the patients that are being served? I'm thinking in particular about, say, some of the quality measures that Minnesota Community Measurement uses to assess quality. What about culturally specific health care? That's not on their list right now. What about using your position as leverage to do that? What about indications of disparities in care, if there are any? Have you given that any thought, and was that written into your proposal?
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's a very good question. We are very concerned about that. A lot of the guidelines that are developed today, for example, are not necessarily intended for people over 75, for example, or not really sensitive to culture or ethnicity either. We're working, in fact, with the health plan council as well as with ICSI, Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement, to talk about how can we develop guidelines that are more sensitive to race and ethnicity. Clearly, we are concerned about that, and we did not introduce that issue and topic here, but I can tell you, when we talk about the six aims of quality improvement, equity is our biggest challenge, because we ranked 38th in this country based on the Commonwealth Fund study in terms of our equity measure. We have to develop better measures around equity. And we're doing that in partnership with the health plans and the providers through the Healthcare Disparities Task Force. Donna Zimmerman, for example, is a critical player in that task force, where we're introducing the ability to collect information around race and ethnicity so that we can better develop measures specific to our clients, but also specific to the populations that we serve. And we serve, of course, a disproportionate number of American Indians and people of color, and we need to develop that kind of measurement, and we intend to do that. In fact, we're going to enter into an arrangement with Minnesota Community Measurement that allows us to collect data specific to our clients. That is a very important aspect of this, and we don't lose sight of that. We believe that we can have a common infrastructure, though. We can have a common approach in terms of how we're developing this kind of value exchange to support all that as well. And everybody we've talked to agrees with that. There's nobody suggesting, okay, let's put that aside. Not at all. Everybody agrees that we need to focus on that as well. So we intend to do that. We intend to be able to collect that kind of information. And again, through the Healthcare Disparities Task Force, we're making that known. So thank you for that question, and I agree. That's the top priority that we have in healthcare in our public programs, is addressing the healthcare disparities issue, because that's the biggest challenge that we're facing, frankly.
Assistant Commissioner, just to get a little better understanding, I understand and agree with this notion of interoperability, and we need to move in that direction. And then we also have kind of the community measurement and the reporting and transparency issues. It's not clear to me how those two pieces fit together within one infrastructure and what you would do with that. They almost seem like separate, two separate things.
Mr. Chairman, I would agree that they probably will be two separate things, okay, organizationally, but not necessarily functionally. Clearly, what has to happen is that in order for Minnesota Community Measurement and all that work to be done effectively, information has to be transmitted some fashion, hopefully electronically. Otherwise, you have to go on an abstract charts from, you know, the medical record. So clearly, they need to be connected. And what we're suggesting is that the value exchange would, if you will, kind of develop the umbrella by which this all comes together. But I would envision that we may have separate entities or separate functions. As I mentioned earlier, we don't envision any longer having one single entity, one single value exchange to see all of this through. But that value exchange, it could be a virtual organization, frankly, will in essence be responsible for tying the pieces together. But clearly, the information exchange work needs to be tied together with the other work, because that's what informs that data.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman.
And it'll be good to get updates as this goes along as well. So if we could get that. I think we're going to take a brief recess now, because I think we're done with the joint part of the meeting. And so the cost containment restructuring group will reconvene in about 5 minutes.
Hi, I'm Laura Vino. And
Dr. Marcus Tigeson from Health Partners is going to talk about what they've learned about pay for performance, as I understand it. So go ahead, Doctor.
Thank you, Representative Tyson, and I apologize in advance for the frog in my voice. I'm getting over a cold, so.
Can I interrupt for just 1 second?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. The other working group, for people who are interested, is meeting in room 112. So just with that commercial interruption, go ahead.
Great.
Thanks.
And let me just, in way of introduction, say that actually I came prepared to talk really about four things, and hopefully this is fits with your agenda. If it doesn't, I'm willing to modify my remarks. But I did want to touch on our experience with pay for performance at Health Partners, and then also speak briefly about some of our disease management results, since those are complementary strategies for improving the care of chronic illness and reducing costs associated with that. I thought it would also be helpful if if we shared with you some of our recent results in terms of working with populations to improve healthy lifestyles, because that is a way to improve health and reduce health care costs for people, even those who don't have chronic illnesses. And then I thought it might be helpful if you would allow me to editorialize about why these programs, while they add, I think, a lot of value, aren't the panacea or the complete solution to healthcare cost trends. And so that I think sometimes people wonder, well, if disease management doesn't solve all the problems, why should we do it? And I think it does a lot of good things, but it doesn't solve all the problems, and that means there's more work to be done. So that's kind of what I had prepared for you today. So on that note, I guess you all have notes. I thought I would start off with my key points, which are, number one, that pay for performance and disease management, I think hopefully you'll, after you see my data, you'll agree with me, they do have the potential to improve the quality of care, improve health care, and also reduce health care costs. I think I will be able to show you some similar data that programs to improve healthy lifestyles have similar benefits. But none of those things address one of the things that's really probably a major healthcare cost driver, which is the unwarranted variation in healthcare for non-evidence-based care. Disease management and pay-for-performance are focused on promoting the delivery of healthcare services that are evidence-based, that we know are recommended for pretty much anybody who has the condition that's being targeted. They're not programs that in any way address the non-evidence-based components of care, which are also part of the care for those people. And it's the variation in those kinds of services that actually leads to a lot of variation in costs around the country, variation in costs in this community, and is associated with the increase in cost. So I'll give you that information as we go forward. Just in terms of the outline here, we're going to spend some time on chronic disease results and then healthy lifestyle results, and then talk a little bit about variation in non-evidence-based care. This wheel is sort of a quality improvement wheel. It diagrams out how we have approached at Health Partners the pay-for-performance model, and this represents really work that's been going on now for about 15 years. And it's work that's been done in collaboration with the healthcare providers in the state of Minnesota, as well as many of the other healthcare payers. So it's work that Health Partners has been very involved in, and to some extent we've taken a leadership role. It's involved the collaboration and partnership with a lot of other stakeholders in the state of Minnesota. The first thing to do is to decide what you want to focus on. What are the key things? Obviously, disease management. We've focused a lot on diabetes and heart disease, depression management, and preventive care services with our pay-for-performance programs. The ICSI, Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement, has played a major role in terms of helping us work with providers to define best care. A key component of these programs being successful is getting agreement about how to measure performance, and then measuring in a very standard, validated way that everybody buys into, and then publishing those results in a way that providers can see their results and compare themselves with other providers, and also so the public can see those results. And frankly, I think that public transparency may have as big an impact on behavior change and performance improvement as the pay-for-performance component does. It's a key integral part of this. In our pay-for-performance programs, we have set targets for performance for various measures, and then we have attached financial rewards. We actually have two different programs, a bonus program, which we call Partners in Excellence, where providers who hit certain very high targets for performance actually get small bonuses and a public recognition. And then we also have a withhold program where there's a small percentage of provider compensation that's withheld at the beginning of the contract year and then is paid out based on performance. So we have two different financial incentives. But it's really the combination of measuring publicly reporting and then linking some financial incentives to that that we think has are the key components of a successful pay-for-performance program. These data, and hopefully you can see that from the front of the room there, shows some improvement in diabetes care. The measures we try to use for both diabetes and heart disease are what we call optimal care. And optimal care is it's a composite measure, meaning that a patient is only considered to be getting optimal care if they are getting all of the care they need, if they're achieving the results that they need on all components of this composite measure. The five key care requirements for a diabetic are that their blood sugar obviously be controlled. It's also very important, perhaps even more important, that their blood pressure be controlled, that their cholesterol level be controlled, that they not be smoking or using tobacco products, and that they be taking an aspirin a day. And so you can see here that we've tracked, actually over many years, I'm just showing you the last 4 years, tracked the individual performance of the diabetics in our population. We use chart reviews and go out and actually survey the charts of our patients on each of these individual components. And we also then track the percent of the diabetic population who are achieving all of these outcomes. These are the folks who have every one of these risk factors controlled. And in the right-hand panel there, you see that at Health Partners in our diabetic population over the last 4 years, and we don't yet have the 2006 data, but it'll be available shortly. In 2002, only 4% of diabetics were achieving optimal care. In 2005, we were up to about 13%. The overall performance in the rest of the state we can see is also going up. We have that data through the Minnesota Community Measurement Collaborative. If we turn to the next page, you'll see that we've also been tracking, in addition to the improvement in optimal care, we've been tracking the complication rates in our diabetics. The expectation is, and this is actually why we want people to get optimal care, that when people are getting the care they need, they'll have fewer complications. This is really where the savings from pay-for-performance comes from.
Senator Berglund.
I hope you don't mind if I interrupt you for a question right now, but one of the arguments that I've been given is that, yes, it does reduce the complication in diabetic patients, but that the savings is mainly accrued to Medicare because these kind of complications are the type of thing that would lead you into becoming disabled and being a Medicare eligible client, not a regular Medicaid client or a regular private insurance client.
That's a very fair question, and obviously complications will occur sometime in the future. I think actually the slide that's being projected right now shows you that, in fact, while certainly many diabetics will have these adverse events, these complications occurring after they've become Medicare eligible, many of them, unfortunately, have these events occur while they're still being covered either by Medicaid or commercial insurance. And, in fact, those are perhaps the most tragic events because they're cutting people's lives short or limiting their productivity early on in their otherwise most productive years. The top line on this graph is the rate of eye complications in the diabetic population at Health Partners, and that's been virtually cut in half in the last decade as a result of improvements in care, primarily driven by this pay-for-performance model. The middle line is the rate of heart attacks. And again, this is all in people who are commercially insured. So the rate of heart attacks in the diabetic population at Health Partners has gone from 16 per 1,000 per year down to 11 per 1,000 per year. That's about a 33% reduction. So those are heart attacks that are being avoided in a commercially insured population. And then finally, the bottom line, it may be hard to see, is the rate of amputations. Diabetes, one of the common complications is loss of lower extremity related to vascular disease. And there you see the rate of amputations gone down 70%.
Representative Huntley has a question.
Dr. Tigerson, how do you answer the statement? It doesn't come from me. It came from somebody else in this room that... it's non-compliant patients. It's not our responsibility. So if the patient doesn't do what we tell them to do, that's not our problem.
Oh, that's another very interesting question. Actually, we've done some work at Health Partners. We actually are blessed with having access not only to the health plan claims data, but also for our Health Partners medical group patients, we have access to medical group's electronic medical record data, which we can use in a de-identified way to compare outcomes and treatment. And, for instance, what we know in our hypertension, our population of folks with hypertension, high blood pressure, that there's a segment of the population, let's just say 30% of people with high blood pressure, whose blood pressure is not properly controlled. It's not controlled to the normal level. It's still elevated, even though they are on treatment. And we know that of that group, 80% of them are taking their medicines as prescribed. There's another 20%. The other 20% are not taking their medicines as prescribed. So you could make the argument that there is a segment of those folks who are not in control because it appears they're not following instructions. Now, maybe they were not adequately instructed, so we can't necessarily blame them for that. But suffice it to say, it looks like there's a patient-related issue, non-compliance with medications, that's associated with their blood pressure not being controlled. But the other 80% are taking their medicines as prescribed, and yet they are not being treated to outcome. And what this is a phenomenon that we've actually been doing a lot of research on at Health Partners is something we call clinical inertia, which is that the physician, for whatever reason, and oftentimes there are very good reasons, is not treating to the desired outcome. Suffice it to say that, I've looked at some of these studies about patients not getting all the evidence-based care that's recommended. And when I first saw the McGlynn article, for instance, my initial reaction as a physician was, patient's non-adherent, maybe these are all patient-related factors. But I was impressed by the fact that most of those treatment requirements or evidence-based recommendations are all are focused on physician behavior, not patient behavior. So, long-winded answer, but in general, I would say that at least a majority of the time, I think the physician does have the ability to play a very important role in addressing these situations where a patient is not achieving the desired outcome. So I want to be sensitive to people's time. I went backwards, sorry. We have similar results for coronary artery disease in terms of achieving optimal care. Here, the percent of patients with coronary artery disease achieving all of the required risk factor control is much better. It's almost 40%. And this just shows the improvement in the risk factors in the population as a whole over the last decade. You can see that the average hemoglobin A1C, which is a measure of blood sugar control in the Health Partners diabetic population, that went from 8.7 in 1994 down to 7.2 in 2005. Normal is less than 7. So roughly about half of the Health Partners diabetics actually now have normal blood sugars. The LDL cholesterol, the bad cholesterol in people with heart disease in 1999 was over 100. The average is now 86. You want it less than 100. So we've seen really tremendous improvement in the population risk factors as a result of these programs. And you might say, well, this could just be the improvement in healthcare around the country. What makes this different? And I think one of the most telling statistics, and I didn't bring the graph, but I'd be glad to share it with you if you like at a later time, is that in a decade ago, the ratio of death rates from coronary artery disease in Minnesota compared to the United States average was 85%. So putting it another way, the risk of dying from heart disease in Minnesota was 85% of what it was nationwide. Last year, it was 65%. And I think you can make a very credible argument that that change, that improvement in prognosis or reduction in risk for people in terms of heart disease in Minnesota is the result of what really has been a statewide quality improvement effort where pay for performance has been a very critical component of that. Now I'm going to shift gears and talk a little bit about our disease management programs. In our disease management programs, I guess I'll back up and say pay for performance is really a provider-focused initiative. It's focused primarily on physicians and other licensed providers. Disease management is more focused on the member. We're focused on addressing those member issues, making sure that they're educated about all things they should be doing to take good care of themselves and that they're working effectively with their physicians. And so we have disease manager programs for quite a large number of chronic illnesses, but diabetes and heart disease are two of them. And we identify people through our claims data or sometimes through our health assessment. We identify those that we think are most at risk and could most benefit from working with us. We reach out to them through a series of mailings and phone calls and explain the program to them. And about somewhere between 70 and 90% of folks who we contact choose to work with one of our nurses to improve the quality of their care. And then we go through several cycles with them or review their care, communicate with their doctor about their treatment plan, and work to try to optimize their care so they can achieve optimal care as I previously defined it. And what this graph shows is for heart disease and diabetes, what percent of the folks signing up for our disease manager programs were achieving optimal care when they first signed up, and then what percent were able to achieve optimal care if they'd been in the program for a while. For heart disease, the dark green bar is how folks are doing at baseline. So you see 36% of people with heart disease signing up for the program, when they signed up, were already achieving optimal care. The light green bar with the 63 on top represents the percent of folks who were achieving optimal care in 2006, at the end of the year 2006, after they'd been in the program long enough to go through two cycles of review. So we've taken a subset of folks who've been in the program long enough to benefit from two cycles of the nurse reviewing their care and developing a new treatment plan with them and with their doctor. And you can see that the percent achieving optimal care is now up to 63%. This is much higher than our population average. And I think it indicates that while pay for performance adds a lot of value, this kind of supplemental program also can help an even greater percentage of folks achieve optimal care. On the diabetes side, 7.6% were achieving optimal care when they first signed up. At the end of 2006, for that group that had been in the program long enough to go through two cycles of review, 36% were achieving optimal care. Again, our population average is about 13% in 2005. We don't have the 2006 number yet.
Representative Huntley.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Tigerson, could you talk really briefly about the calls from the nurses? Are those coming from a nurse directly working for the physician that has that patient, or are they coming from a nurse that works for Health Partners in their central administration?
They actually come from nurses who work for Health Partners, the Health Partners plan, and they're located in our administration building in Bloomington. Any other questions on this slide? We do have estimated savings. We do have estimated savings for both the disease management programs and for the pay-for-performance programs. We actually use an external expert, a guy named Al Lewis, frankly, who's a well-known, nationally known expert in disease management and has been a very well-known and prominent critic of some of the sloppy methodologies that have been used to estimate savings from disease management programs. And we use him actually to make sure that we're using as good technique as possible in terms of determining what the savings really are. Because we're a health plan and we take risk ourselves, we want to make sure that these programs obviously are managing our risk. We also have a fiduciary obligation to our clients whose benefits we administer that we're administering a program that's really delivering value. On average, we estimate that our ROI for disease management is about 2-to-1. These disease management programs do cost a fair amount of money because this nurse outreach and telephonic support is not inexpensive. These nurses are well-paid professionals, as are the nurses who work in the care delivery system. But the savings that we can attribute to these programs is about twice the amount that the programs actually cost.
And Mr. Chairman?
Senator Berglund.
Over what period of time was this savings measured?
Our usual methodology is to develop a study population that includes everybody with the condition, and we develop a baseline period so we can establish a sort of baseline trend in that population, and then we look and see over the next 2 years, what is happening to the trend in that population, and how does it compare to the trend prior to that, and then we use that as a way to estimate the savings. The other thing we do is we look at the use of hospitalizations and emergency room visits as a sort of a checkpoint or a validation to make sure that there was enough of a change in the use of those high cost services to gets kind of a credibility check on the estimated savings.
Can you talk just a little bit more about what you're talking about when you're talking about return on investment and what that translates into in practical terms, like in money terms?
How many dollars?
Well, not money, not your specific dollars, but
yeah,
where those dollars end up, what happens with the where do those savings, where do those savings go?
Well, typically a disease management program is a suite of disease management programs is going to cost, depending on what's included and how they're operated, $3, $4, $5, $6 per member per month, okay? And so the savings you get a sense of if the ROI is 2-to-1, then the net savings is about the same amount. If we're fully insured, if it's a fully insured client, then those are savings that we take on, basically. We build that into our pricing model on our premium, so we have some expectations about what impact this will be on our risk. And then so it helps mitigate our risk. If it's a self-funded client, then those are basically costs that they've managed to avoid and don't spend because of these programs.
So when you say you manage it into your risk, that means you charge them a lower premium because you're expecting these savings to come from it.
Right.
You're charging them $3 to $4 more for the program, though, or whatever the number is.
In a fully insured business, we don't charge a separate fee for our disease management services.
Okay.
We just charge a premium, and all of our administrative, that premium covers our expected healthcare claims risk as well as our administrative costs.
The money's actually ending up with the client, the savings.
The savings gets passed on to the client because we can keep our premiums lower.
That's what I meant.
Yeah.
Yes, that's what I meant. Representative Huntley.
Yeah, brief again. Do you attribute the disease management then as a healthcare cost or as an administrative cost?
We account for it as an administrative cost. It's not paid as a claim. It's paid as an administrative cost, or it's administrative cost we take on. So it's not part of the med loss ratio, if you will. It's part of our administrative costs. Any other questions on this? I'm going to spend a little time on the issue of healthy behavior. Or unhealthy behavior. And to be frank, this has been quite an eye-opener for me in the last few years. But Health Partners has developed a health assessment. And when you take our health assessment, it gives you a health risk score, a health potential score. And the higher your score, the healthier you are. And you can score up to 1,000 points on this health potential score. And we have been able to correlate the health potential score that comes off our health assessment with the health care costs that people have during the year. And what we find is that, and it's not surprising, the higher your health potential score, the lower your health care costs. And so the graph here on your left just shows that inverse relationship. We've broken up the population in terms of the health potential score on the x-axis, and we're showing you the average annual health care claims cost for folks in each of those categories on the y-axis. And you can see there's an inverse relationship. Now, not everything in your health potential score is modifiable. If you have a family history for diabetes or you had a heart attack, those are not things you can change. But there are things you can change. You can change your diet. If you work hard at it, you can probably change your body mass index. You can quit smoking. You can get more physical activity. It may not be easy to do those things, but they are modifiable. And so we actually can break down that health potential score into a subscore, which we call the modifiable health potential score. And what I've done here is I've graphed on the right-hand side the average health care cost, annual health care cost, versus the modifiable health potential score. And again, you see there's a somewhat inverse relationship here as well. There's this group over on the left-hand side that says they have very low modifiable health potential scores. I think what that is relatively young people who live unhealthy lifestyles that are, age-related, and yet have not yet suffered the wages of sin, if you will. When you actually do an age and gender adjustment of these numbers, so you're just looking at what's the relationship between the modifiable health potential score and healthcare claims costs, we find that on average, there's the value of a modifiable health potential score point is $7.30, meaning that if you changed your behavior and increased your modifiable health potential score by 10 points, we would expect on average next year your health care claims cost would be $73 less. You follow me? And what that means is that the folks that are not optimizing their modifiable health potential score are incurring extra costs on average that would go away pretty quickly if they change to a healthier lifestyle. And the value of all that unhealthy behavior in this population was about 22% of total health care cost. We have another client with a much older population, obviously higher non-behavior related costs, and for them, the percent of health care cost related to unhealthy behavior is about 17%. So we would say on average, maybe a fifth of all health care costs are related to unhealthy behaviors, which if those behaviors were modified and converted to healthy behavior, those costs would disappear within a year or two. And I'll show you a case study that illustrates this. This is a client of ours. We've been doing a pilot program now for 4 years. It's a manufacturing employer in the Minneapolis area. And 4 years ago, they implemented a benefit incentive for their employees and dependents, where the employees, to get the usual standard benefit, which was, a $10 copay, they were required to take a health assessment. And if they were identified as being at high risk with a health assessment, they were required to participate in a health improvement program. They didn't have to achieve a normal blood pressure or normal body mass index. They just had to participate in a program of their choosing. And we now have 4 years of health assessment data, so we can track the impact in the population. We also have the claims data from each year. And we've had each year over 1,700 employees and spouses participate. That's about over 90% of the adults in the population. And we've seen a sustained improvement in population health. The percent of folks who are reaching the Surgeon General's recommendation on physical activity went from about 50% to over 75%. There was a 0.26 reduction in the average body mass index, 34% reduction in tobacco use, almost a doubling of the intake of fruits and vegetables, and the average modifiable health potential score in this population went up 25 points. So we can actually use that change in the modifiable health potential score to predict that this employer should have saved about $840,000 in health care costs during the 3 years spanned by this work. We actually have looked in the claim stream and found that their actual savings appear to be closer to $965,000. Their actual claims costs have dropped below what we expected based on the risk in the population, the prevalence of chronic illness, et cetera. And so the actual estimated savings is almost $1 million in direct medical costs. We've seen a 17% reduction in the hospitalization rate in this population as well. We think this is one of the first clear-cut proofs in our mind that focusing on unhealthy lifestyles and getting folks to change to a healthier lifestyle does, in fact, make a lot of sense. It saves money. It lowers health care costs in the short term.
Representative Huntley.
Dr. Tigerson again, and Mr. Chairman. Was this company self-insured through through you, or were this a regular insurance?
When this project first started, they were fully insured. We were the risk-bearing entity, and then I believe last year they converted to, I know they're self-funded now, and I think that happened in 06, so that last year they became self-funded.
And if they had not, what do you do about one company then that does this with their employees and reduces their costs versus the premiums for another company that doesn't do that?
We have built into our renewals some allowances for participation in this program. So we basically, this program actually costs a fair amount to administer, but we provide it for free without any increase in premium to those employers who are fully insured. And obviously, if we have the kind of experience we had with this employer, then that'll keep our premium increases from going up.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Dr. Tigerson, do you have any evidence from your work or others about the sustainability of those efforts with continued modification of their premium? Do they sustain those kind of improvements? So I think one of the challenges we have here is coming up with the proper kind of realignment of the incentives in the system for sustainable change.
That's a great question. This study, as I said, has gone on now for 4 years. So we have 4 years of health assessment data. And actually the biggest change was in the first year. But in every subsequent year, the health potential score has continued to go up. And except for body mass index, where there's been a slight regression and the average BMI went up the fourth year a little bit, it's still not anywhere near as high as it was. In every other case, the performance has continued to improve. Not as much as in the first year, but incrementally it's getting better. So to me, that's one of the most gratifying things about this, is not only did we have not only did we move the needle, but the needle seems to have stayed over and can be continuing to move in the right direction. But that obviously is a concern that we have. We want to make sure this remains a sustainable program and that people don't start to relapse. I would also add that this program, the success of this program, represented a significant commitment and a lot of investment of executive support on the part of the employer here as well. This is not just a health plan initiative. We had a great partner in our employer client.
Senator Berglund.
Was there any opportunity to analyze the group of people that were involved in this to see how many people avoided the onset of diabetes, for example, or how many avoided the onset of heart disease?
We have data about what we should be able to see there. We're actually right in the middle now of doing a sort of individual level analysis. The data I've shown you so far is sort of a population level analysis, mm-hmm. but we're actually taking the de-identified data at the individual level and looking to see, so what actually happened to individuals with specific risks who participated or did not participate in the program, and can we answer those kinds of questions?
I'd be interested when you get that information and seeing it.
I look forward to bringing that back.
Dr. Roden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question. Could you talk a little bit more about what the what the costs were to do the program? I mean, where the money got spent? You'd made just a reference in one of your comments about that it was expensive to do, or there was cost involved. So I was just wondering if you could just talk a little bit about like what those costs
were. Most of the cost for the program comes from the health improvement programs, which are mainly telephonic counseling. We actually have some web-based programs. Our 10,000 Steps program is web-based, and you get a pedometer and you do all that stuff. But all the other programs are phone-based. So we actually mail you a binder with a curriculum, and you typically have 8 to 10 phone conversations with a professionally trained health educator, health counselor, who walks you through that curriculum at your own pace and helps you make the changes that you need to make. And so that's a fairly intensive investment. Each one of those phone courses, I think $200 per phone course is probably a typical cost for the program. And so we had about 25% of the adults in this population participating in those programs every year. And then the employer also incurred some costs in terms of they have a full-time occupational health nurse who runs their side of the program, and they had some promotional communication expenses as well. So.
Okay. You can continue. Thank you.
Okay. Am I out of time?
No. Continue. Oh,
all right.
Yes.
I'm willing to shut up if you need me to. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about why I think as valuable and important as these programs are, they're not the panacea. They're not going to solve our health care cost issues. And I call your attention back to the Dartmouth Atlas work, John Wenberg, David Wenberg, and Elliot Fisher in particular. I think you all probably heard a lot about this. They divide healthcare services into three categories: effective care, supply-sensitive care, and preference-sensitive care. Effective care are things that are very evidence-based. We have a lot of good data showing that these are things that are effective. They're generally stand out, and they don't have a lot of competitive interventions that they compete with. They're, you know, if you're a diabetic, you need to have your blood sugar controlled. The best test for that's a hemoglobin A1C. You're not going to find much argument about that. And they're generally recommended for everybody with a given condition. There are not a lot of trade-offs for somebody in making a decision whether to get effective care. Preference-sensitive care are services where there are maybe several different evidence-based treatments that are available for a condition. The different treatments have different trade-offs associated with them, different risks and benefits, and the value of those risks and benefits is very dependent on the preferences of the patient. So the actual best choice for that patient will be strongly dependent on their preferences and values. If you're a woman who is having midlife issues and is thinking about maybe having a hysterectomy, whether or not you want to preserve your fertility is a key issue for you. That's an example of a preference-sensitive decision. All right? Hysterectomy or other treatments are all evidence-based. They all work. They have similar outcomes, but they have different risks and benefits, different outcomes. And patient needs to be thoughtful about those in making their mind up. Supply-sensitive care are services that there isn't really a lot of medical evidence about whether they actually add much value. They're typically low-cost, high-volume services, but they're not really evidence-based. An example of this would be the frequency with which a doctor sees a patient back in the office. One of the most challenging things I had to do after I left my residency and went into private practice for the first time was figure out, well, when am I going to see this person back in the office? Nobody ever taught me that. There's no guideline on that, you know. And if you look at how doctors have their patients come back to see them in the office, say a stable patient with hypertension, there's wide variation in the frequency with which that service is used. So that's an example of a supply-sensitive service. And, in fact, hospital days, hospital visits, specialty consults, office visits, lab testing, x-ray, these are all classic examples of supply-sensitive services. The reason they're called supply-sensitive is that, on average, about 50% of the variation in the delivery of these services, the utilization, is related to the supply of providers or hospital beds in a community. So if you just bear with me here. This is just another diagram from the Dartmouth Atlas. It shows all the hospital referral regions that they use in doing their analysis. This happens to show the variation in Medicare spending amongst the different hospital referral regions. You'll see here that Minnesota looks pretty good, right? And I think some of us might be inclined to think, well, that means that we don't have a problem with healthcare spending or supply-sensitive care in Minnesota. But actually, when you look at the variation within any one of these communities, there's just about as much variation in a community as there is around the country, and there's just about as much variation between doctors in a clinic as there are between clinics. So there's variation all the way down. All right. So we do better than on average, but there's still a tremendous amount of variation in the use of resources in our community, and lots of opportunity for improvement. This graph just shows the difference between supply-sensitive care and non-supply-sensitive care. Hip fracture, the admission rate for hip fracture is a flat line when you plot it out against the number of hospital beds in the community. Doesn't matter whether you got a hospital on every corner or one, just one in town. If you fall down and break your hip, you're almost certainly going to present to the doctor. The doctor is almost certainly going to make that diagnosis, and there's only one way to manage that, and that's to hospitalize you. So there's not a lot of discretion there, and therefore there's not much variation in the hospitalization rate. But if you look at the hospitalization rate for all medical conditions combined, these are not surgical conditions, but all medical conditions, you see that there's actually a linear relationship between the hospitalization rate and the supply of hospital beds in the community, and the R squared on that is 0.54, which means that bed supply explains about 50% of the variation in hospitalization rates in the community. The other big thing that's related to supply-sensitive care is variation in physician judgment, or what's called propensity to intervene. Physicians vary in terms of their comfort level with uncertainty, how they were trained, their aggressiveness with which they tend to pursue symptoms, and that kind of thing leads to variation in supply-sensitive services. So why is this important? Well, Elliot Fisher and David Weinberg published a study in the Annals of Internal Medicine in 2003 where they looked at a number of different chronic conditions in the Medicare population, and they divided all of the hospital referral regions in the country into five quintiles based on the total cost of care for people with those conditions in those communities. And then they looked at the distribution of evidence-based care, effective care, preference-sensitive care, and supply-sensitive care in those communities to try to get a sense of what variation in care is being associated with the variation in cost. You with me? And so what I've plotted here is the ratio of for effective care, for things that everybody should be getting, whether it's for an acute heart attack or for just general wellness screening, the ratio of utilization of these services in the high-spending regions compared to the low-spending regions. And you'll see that they're close to one. In fact, for the general population screening measures, they're less than one, which means, in fact, that in the high-spending regions, people are getting less preventive care. You follow me? So high-spending regions are not buying more preventive care. The next graph, yes.
Yes,
thank you. Does that have anything to do? I mean, like you were looking when I was looking at the map. I mean, a lot of it in the red was in the south. So when you're talking about the fact that they're not having preventative, is it mostly because they don't have access to?
I can assure you that there is no problem with access in Florida. In fact, it's just the opposite. The high-spending regions have oversupply or have, let's say, a very rich supply of hospitals and physicians, particularly medical specialists. So it's not that there aren't enough physicians. In fact, the higher the supply of providers, typically the higher the use of these supply-sensitive services. This next graph shows the ratio for preference-sensitive services, which are often major surgeries, utilization in the high-spending regions versus the low-spending regions. Again, the ratio is close to one. Excuse me. So these communities that are spending a lot of money on health care are not getting more major surgery. They're not getting more angiograms or bypass surgeries. What they are getting is more office visits, more inpatient visits, more specialty consultations, more electrocardiograms, more x-rays, more CTs and MRIs, more hospital days, more feeding tubes, and emergency intubations at the end of life. Those are supply-sensitive services. And my interpretation of this data is that the major driver, the major reason why different communities or different providers have higher or lower costs is their use of these non-evidence-based supply-sensitive services, not the use of evidence-based care. The Weinberg and Fisher group have gone on to look at other quality measures. Mortality rates are actually higher in the high-spending regions. More supply-sensitive care is associated with the physician specialist supply, the hospital bed supply, fragmentation of care. In those communities where there's high use of supply-sensitive care, there are more people who have a large number of doctors participating in their care. It's also associated with low patient satisfaction, low provider job satisfaction, slower rates of quality improvement, and higher medical trend. So disease management, and pay for performance are focused on promoting effective evidence-based care. They are not typically focused on eliminating or managing or reducing the unwarranted variation of supply-sensitive care. They save money and they improve health care, but they are not addressing what is probably the major cost driver in the system, which is the unwarranted variation in this non-evidence-based care. So I think, you know, we need to support them, and they're good programs, but they're also not going to solve all of our problems. Elliot Fisher has proposed some strategies for addressing the unwarranted variation in supply-sensitive care. I've listed some of them here. I would just make the overall comment that none of these strategies are easy or simple and will not be amenable to a simple-minded solution. Provider decision support is actually a strategy we recently have had some experience with. Health partners, other health plans, and ICSI have collaborated along with other medical groups to develop decision support programs for physicians when they're ordering a CT or an MRI to make sure they're following an evidence-based guideline. We are seeing some reduction in the use of this high-tech diagnostic imaging, and we think it's actually improving the quality of care. So that's an example of a strategy that appears to work, at least for that issue. We're very interested in looking more into how do we design benefits that are very rich for evidence-based effective care and that are lean enough to give people an affordable stake in the game to ask the question, do I really need this when it's a non-evidence-based service? I think the presumption for most people in our society is that, in general, in healthcare, more is better. The actual evidence indicates that actually more is not better. Healthcare, too much healthcare can kill you. And then finally, other strategies include promoting coordination of care in the medical home. Payment reform is probably critical right now. Provider payment based on the Medicare model is pay for throughput, pay for process, but not pay for value or outcomes. And I think that needs to be changed. And then finally, the issue of provider supply is a really tough one. There's been a lot of work in the community recently about the medical arms race and other things like that. If you have a lot of hospital beds and specialists and equipment in the community to provide care, they need to generate a certain revenue to cover their costs, and they may end up doing that. If you reduce the number of heart attacks, they'll find some other way to make sure they can stay in business. So none of these things are easy things to tackle. I'm not here to recommend certificates of need, for example. But I do think that we do need to work on redesigning our healthcare system so that it does address this problem of unwarranted variation in supply-sensitive care.
Senator Berglund.
Is there some relationship between self-referral and the amount of supply-sensitive care that's provided?
I think self-referral can play a component in that. But some of the communities where the problem is most pronounced, oftentimes they're small groups, and it's not that there's a lot of self-referral going on. I mean, that's certainly part of it. But a lot of this is just that when you have a whole bunch of doctors providing care in a community, I'll just give you an example of how this happens. When I used to make rounds in the hospital, this is before the advent of effective hospitalist programs, you might have four or five specialists seeing a patient every day. Everybody trying to act in good faith, but probably doing a lot of the work they were doing could have been done by one hospitalist who maybe had telephonic back up with the specialists, but now you've got four or five docs, and they're all each one writing a note every day. Before, electronic medical records not always very legible, and so they've got to coordinate with each other. They got to read each other's notes. They got to talk to each other. Unfortunately, it doesn't always happen, and so you have coordination problems. You have duplication of effort problems. You have multiple physicians submitting multiple bills, where in fact that patient might have been done well with just a hospital seeing them every day and then touching bases with a specialist on an as-needed basis. So that's more likely how this kind of thing evolves. This is not a matter of moral turpitude. It's the way the system is set up because of the way people are paid for their services.
Senator Bergman.
One of the things you have on the list is the value-based benefits. Has anybody developed a value-based benefit set?
Well, we have some examples of it, actually. Most of the health plans, most of the health plan products in the state now have 100% coverage for preventive care. That's an example of a value-based benefit. That's a set of effective care services that are essentially free to members. And we're looking at ways to expand that concept to include services for secondary prevention. There are more and more health plan products available. We offer one ourselves where certain kinds of medications that are used for preventive care, like diabetes, are offered free of charge or with minimal copays. That'd be another example of a value-based benefit. The program that employer instituted where they had a richer benefit for people that participated in a health improvement program and made those programs free to people, that's an example of a value-based benefit. The flip side is that when you start charging a small co-insurance for CT and MRI, for instance, that's also a value-based benefit. People should have a little skin in the game for those kinds of services because oftentimes those services are overused. And you want people to ask the question, doc, do I really need this? Because not infrequently the physician will say, we don't absolutely have to get it done. Let's wait and see what happens. And not infrequently it turns out that it wasn't necessary.
Mr. Chairman and Doctor, the reason I'm asking the question is because we've been trying to move toward payment through our public programs only for procedures that are necessary. But the real obstacle that we've run into is the only tool we have really to implement it is prior authorization. Well, as you said earlier, a lot of these things are low cost, high volume services. And so the prior approval cost for us is more than the savings right. We would get by denying the benefit. And we have to, run everything through there, even the ones that should be approved as well as the ones that shouldn't, and pay for that prior approval processing.
Yeah, prior authorization is a very simple-minded technique for a very complex problem. It implies that you can break down services into neat categories. Medically appropriate, not medically appropriate. In fact, that is true for certain kinds of things. There's a bright enough line you can draw that line, and it makes sense to do that for certain relatively rare, high-cost services. But for the vast majority of healthcare services, it's too crude and expensive a technique for effective management, and it's certainly not a very member-friendly thing to do. So I sympathize with that. I think it's more desirable to come up with benefit designs that that create the right incentives, and with payment provider payment models that create the right incentives, as well as then the decision support that people need to make the right decisions, and use those kinds of approaches to deal with what really is a very complex decision-making process where you don't really want to get in the middle of it. You want to create the right incentives, and then you want to let the doctors and the patients who are trying to do the right thing, when they're properly incented, let them do the right thing without a lot of interference.
When we contract with the health plans like yours for our public clients, do you have any criteria on the physicians that are providing the services in regard to the frequency with which they provide certain services? Or it's very difficult for us to build in a co-payment structure for low-income people that you are describing, because if you have too high of a co-payment, they're not going to
right.
receive the service even when it is warranted?
Well, I think you sort of asked me two questions. One is, what kind of data do we have on physicians? We have quite a large amount of data, certainly at the clinic and group level, about physician resource use for the physicians that, you know, see most of our patients. We have a fair amount, but nowhere near as much quality information as we would like. We focused on things like diabetes and heart disease, where we have a lot, but there are obviously a lot of other things that go on that we don't have a lot of quality data on. So we have a fair amount, and we know a fair amount about how much variation there is in the use of resources. I can tell you, for instance, in diabetes, that the variation in resource use per diabetic episode between providers is about three times as much variation there as there is in the variation in quality. So there's a tremendous amount of variation in resource use, and there's no relationship between quality and resource use. Some of the highest performing provider groups in terms of quality have some of the lowest amounts of resource use. In terms of the benefit design thing, obviously, if whatever benefit structure is designed for Medicaid-type population needs to be scaled down to reflect their incomes. I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about Medicaid-type copays, I'll be frank with you, so I don't want to hazard too much of a suggestion on that. But certainly in the commercial population, we've seen employers who, for instance, have one benefit structure for their highly compensated employees and another benefit structure for their less well-compensated employees, where the copays are smaller and the coinsurance is smaller and the out-of-pocket maximum is smaller for their less well-compensated employers, as a way to try to tailor the financial burden so it's a more appropriately scaled to the resources that employee has. Mm-hmm. And I would think that a similar kind of concept could apply to the Medicaid population, where the copays would be nothing for a set of evidence-based services and very, very small, but still something for the less evidence-based care. I've gotten health care recently myself, and I'm always fascinated to see the kinds of decisions that doctors make about my health and compare them to what I would do, you know. And I'll be frank with you, I've had a number of experiences in the last few years where I'm thinking, why are we doing this, you know? But I'm a good patient, and I did what my doctor told me.
I was just wondering, what's your best guess at, of all the medicine that's practiced out there, how much of it, what percent is actually evidence-based? I'm just trying to guess.
Truly evidence-based, the way the Dartmouth Atlas folks would call it?
Well, why don't we do that one and then do sort of along when you think about pay-for-performance and disease management, if it's different, what group you would put into that?
Well, I'm not sure I can answer that question exactly the way it was framed, but let me, the Elizabeth McGlynn study that came out of the New England Journal of Medicine around 2000 indicated that only 55% of Americans got all the care that was recommended that was evidence-based. So we're only hitting about 50% on what should be done from an evidence-based standpoint. We also know from the work that the folks did on Dartmouth Atlas and supply-sensitive care that probably about 25% or maybe even 30% of healthcare costs are demonstrably unnecessary and related to very unwarranted variation in the supply of preference-sensitive care. So I would say at a minimum, 30% of healthcare costs are not evidence-based. If you want my sort of subjective sense, I would say at least half of healthcare costs, in my experience, are primarily the result of physician judgment. And that judgment is based on a subset of the medical evidence. But they're decisions that if you asked another physician, how would you have done this, they would have done it differently. And again, I don't know how much lower that is, but I feel pretty comfortable saying that at least 50% of healthcare is not evidence-based.
Thank you.
in that strict sense. It's judgment based.
Mr. Benner.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is more a comment in response to Senator Bergman's question than it is a question for Dr. Tigerson. In the last round of health insurance bargaining with the state employee group, the state actually came to the table with an initial proposal to try to grapple with value-based benefits on diabetes. Needless to say, the unions were more than happy to play on this, but when it came down to figure out how to actually implement this on the ground through the health plans we contract with, the answer came, well, we got to do some pilots first to actually figure out how to make this work. And so at some point during the next 2 years, there will be some targeted efforts at waiving copays for insulin for diabetics. But the what we had thought on both sides of the table was a relatively straightforward good thing to do. And there's enough academic evidence out there now that says, yes, this makes sense. You get better care and you lower your costs. The ability to administer that in the interactions between health plans and payers and provider organizations isn't there yet. And I'm not making this as an attack on health plans here, but it does strike me that if this is a place we think we need to go, health plans and provider organizations need to be putting a level of effort into figuring out how you actually do this so that when you show up with the card, they know this is what's supposed to happen. That is put into designing yet another new health plan offering. There's an investment here that I think pays off big time, but the investment has to be made, and whether that's something that we need to juice or something that it simply needs to be made more explicit that that's a desirable product, because I think the issues for the MA population are no different on this than the issues for employed populations. We have benefit designs where, because we can raise copays as an easy thing to do to save premium costs, every employer, every union, every health plan, every renewal figures a way that, we'll balance the premium issue with yet another round of out-of-pockets. And while on some stuff it may make a lot of sense to increase the patient's skin in the game, we also know we're doing stuff which is actually actively discouraging the receipt of appropriate care. And I guess in this part I am being somewhat critical of plans and provider organizations. It's not as though folks are running to purchasers saying, here is a really nifty value-based benefit design which we think would make sense for you. I mean, the pilots on this have been, there's one at University of Michigan, which was actually brought in by a researcher in the medical school who, this was a result of work he had been doing on his own, and was able, to convince the dean or the president or whomever does these things that it was a good thing to do. Some of the others have been effectively sponsored, actually, by pharmaceutical companies as a method of increasing the sales of their prescription drugs. This would actually be a case where they were right, that buying more drugs save you other medical costs, but there's not been a lot of work done by the health plan industry or the provider industry to tell us how to do this. And it strikes me that it's an appropriate thing for us to be asking both the health plan and the provider industry to say, okay, guys, if you want to do this, here's how it would happen.
If I may make a comment on that, Mr. Banner has, I think, brought up a very important point. The health plan claim systems are set up to pay out benefits based at the group level, not the individual level. That's just how they're architected, and when you have your insurance card, you look, there's a group number, and everybody with that group number has the same benefits, and the claims payment system basically pays claims based on how the benefits are set up for that group number, not how they're set up for your individual member number. And as a consequence, if somebody wants us to administer a program where we're only going to pay a special copay or have no copay for certain drugs if you're a diabetic, then we have to be able to administer that based on knowing you're a diabetic. And that's not a group-level benefit. That's an individual-level benefit. And the claim systems are not set up to support that. So that then means we have to manage those claims manually, and that creates all kinds of other problems. And so there are some significant operational challenges with that particular approach to value-based benefits. On the other hand, if you want us to have insulin be free for everybody, obviously there are very few people who use insulin who aren't diabetics. I probably have the same functional outcome. That's something we can administer. We can set up your group so that there's no copay for insulin. On the flip side of that is on the provider side, they have their systems in place to collect copays and et cetera. And if there's some special workaround they have to do for you because of your particular individual benefit level with Health Partners or whatever health plan you're a member of, that creates headaches for them as well. So it's been an eye-opener for me in my career to realize how important it is that when we come up with these great ideas that we also make sure that they're operational as well as, effective.
Senator Bringman.
So, Mr. Chairman and Doctor, kind of back to the question I asked earlier, I said, has anybody developed a value-based benefit set? And I guess what I meant to say is, has anybody developed a value-based benefit set that's being implemented?
And I would say that the answer to that is that it's been done in a fragmented way. There are different versions of this and different health plans around the country. I'm not aware of anybody having come out with one that I would consider to be comprehensive, but I certainly am aware of different elements of benefit design that I would call value-based that have been adopted by various health plans and various products.
So it might be possible to pull together things from around the country and try and put them together to get one comprehensive value-based benefit set?
It'd be a work in progress because you'd start with one set and pretty soon you'd decide you want to add a few other things or tweak it here, or tweak it there. But yeah, I think it's certainly possible to sit down and design a value-based benefit product that is built on our best knowledge right now about how to do that.
By December?
By the summer.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment. My takeaway from Dr. Tigerson today, you can tell me if I have this wrong, but both what you told us you could do, you have been doing, and what it doesn't fix, is that we've got a very hard job because to get where we're trying to go requires not only that we provide financial incentives, but also disincentives for both providers and patients. And so everybody actually has some significant skin in this game.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chairman and Dr. Tigerson, I want to get back to a question I asked earlier. Just your answer was fine. I'm just trying to understand. The disease management, you said, was considered an administrative cost. Does that trouble with Health Partners is that they're an unusual organization. They're both a health plan and a healthcare provider. So does that show up on the health plan's administrative cost, or does it show up on the administrative cost of the delivery system?
It shows up on the health plan's administrative cost.
I was hoping you'd say that.
Yeah. I think there's some interest, increasing interest actually in the provider community to do disease management themselves. And in fact, there's a very interesting project that's being worked on now in a collaborative way by the health plans and the medical groups and through ICSI to develop a way for health plans and other payers to essentially pay providers for doing depression disease management in a way. It's called the Diamond Project. And so I think that it's quite possible, particularly now that we have a large number of providers who have electronic medical records, that we'll see those disease management functions start to move back into the clinical setting. That's not a bad thing if it's been being done well and properly.
Can I just ask one more question on that same slide? I think that Representative Huntley was looking at. When you go in and are talking to, say, a self-insured company then on the disease management program, are you going to them and saying, if you pay for this, we expect that it's going to save you this amount of money? I mean, do you have that kind of a specific level of conversation? And maybe you can't answer that and shouldn't publicly. I don't know. That you can have their discretion if you don't want to. But and if you so
no, I'm comfortable answering that question. Okay. I mean, we basically for self-funded employers, we charge them a fee, an administrative service only fee, for our administrative services, and we typically will itemize that for them and show them what that fee is purchasing. It's purchasing the ID card and claims payment and member services, phone support, and the website, and all of our health and care management programs, including our disease management programs. And we tell them, you know, we think this is a fair price for this. It's what it's cost us to deliver the service. And the reason you want to buy it is because it's going to save you a lot more than that in claims cost. Now, some of our employers buy the whole package of services from us. Others will buy a subset of those services, and maybe they want to outsource disease management to a different company. So we have a variety of situations, and sometimes they do buy the whole package from us, and other times they may decide, you know, we don't want disease management from you, we want it from somebody else.
And for a fully insured plan, would you go and say to someone, we're going to provide this service to you, and this is how much your premium is less because of it?
Well, typically what fully insured business is sold, basically, you know, here's what you're buying. You're buying all of our administrative services, and we take on the risk of your health care claims costs, and this is your premium. And we have a underwriting process that does the underwriting on that and includes, you know, depending on the size of the group, some kind of standardized underwriting process. Plus, we know what our administrative costs are likely to be based on the group characteristics as well. And then there's a competitive bidding process, and so the group picks the vendor they want, often based on price, but not always. And then we try to do a fair job of the renewal process. When we are lucky enough to get the business, we have a renewal every year where we look at their experience in the prior year and look what the trend is, and then we adjust from that baseline. So we don't go in and say, well, we're going to lower your premium specifically because of the disease management program, but that's built into our underwriting process.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. Okay. I'm just – what I'm trying to get at is if there's a way to get a hard – like kind of a hard number. I have the 2-to-1 number here, but – and if so, if it's part of your business practice, that you would tell me it would be, but it doesn't sound necessarily like you'd do that as part of your discussion.
Well, we can certainly get you an estimated sort of PM savings from disease management. I mean, I typically – don't break it out that way. A lot of my job is to meet with our larger clients and explain to them what's going on with their population and their claims and all that. And my experience is that typically our health management and pharmacy management programs, depending on the risk burden in the population, probably takes about 10-15% of health care costs saves them about 10-15% of their health care costs. So some of that's pharmacy costs. The rest of it is all of our medical management programs. And it's about 50-50. I'm giving you very, you know, high-level numbers, so don't quote me on this. But of all that medical management cost, then some of that is the disease management savings. Some of it is our case management program. Some of it is the utilization review prior authorization that we still do for certain kinds of situations. So buried in that 15% is all of those health and medical management programs.
Representative Huntley, and then I think we'll move on to the next.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman and Doctor, do you have anything you could share with us on in the healthy behavior kinds of incentives? Are people, my bias would be that they're more likely to listen to their employer than they are to an insurance company or particularly to the state, saying they have to do something or lose weight. Do you have any information on that?
Well, I think the most effective person to help a person change their lifestyle is going to be their physician. I think there's pretty good data to support that. And we, frankly, have tried to leverage that relationship wherever we can. We have seen very successful employer-based programs where there's staff in the work site that have built up trust with the employees, and they're able to really support the people in making changes. We've had a lot of success as a health plan with folks working with us, and we have lots of testimonials from our members about how much they've received, how much they've benefited from these programs. And we've seen, even with public entity employers, we've seen significant progress, I think, made in terms of the willingness for employees to trust the process and to over time, particularly to recognize that, in fact, their employer really is interested in helping them live healthy lifestyles, and this is not we're not trying to just get secret information on them so we can deny them insurance or share their health care information with some nefarious secret entity or something like that. But there's a lot of concern about those sorts of things initially when these programs get started, and people just have the experience over time that, you know, there aren't those breaches of trust, that there isn't the break in confidentiality, their information isn't misused, and that the programs can be very helpful and beneficial.
Well, thank you for coming.
Thank
today.
You. This is very helpful.
I can figure this out. Ms. Sonia, do you want to come on up? Hi, welcome again. Good to see you. So you're going to give us some information about the Massachusetts Health Insurance Connector, I think, right?
Yes.
Thank you. Well, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me to speak with you today. My name is Julie Sonier. I'm director of the Health Economics Program at the Minnesota Department of Health, and I've been asked to provide a very brief overview today of the Massachusetts Health Insurance Connector and how it works. Most of the information that I will have for you today I've actually drawn from presentations that I've seen at national conferences by people who were very heavily involved in either the passage of the 2006 health reform law in Massachusetts or implementing the connector. So I just want to give credit where credit is due. But there's been a wealth of information, and I've tried to summarize it very briefly here. I want to start out by just very quickly talking about the basic information on the concept of a health insurance connector, or as it was called in the governor's proposal here in Minnesota this year, a health insurance exchange, and then talk about Massachusetts's connector and how it fits into the larger reforms that they enacted, how it works, and what the connector authority's duties and operations are, and then just spend a minute at the end talking about some characteristics of health insurance markets in Minnesota that really influenced how they developed their policies, and there were some very specific problems in their markets that they were trying to address. Basic goals of the health insurance connector or exchange concept is to improve market functioning by both increasing market transparency and health plan competition. It provides a single place to go for information on available health plans and benefit sets and pricing. It is intended to promote portability of health insurance when people change jobs. And it's also intended to promote affordability of private health insurance coverage in the following way. Under current federal tax law, people who receive employer-sponsored insurance coverage and people who are self-employed can pay for their health insurance premiums with pre-tax dollars. People who don't have that option, in other words, people who have to go to the individual market and purchase coverage on their own, do not have that ability to use pre-tax dollars. And one of the functions of a health insurance exchange is to provide a mechanism by which people who purchase non-group coverage can access those same tax advantages, and it improves affordability to them personally. Some key features of the 2006 Massachusetts health reform, of which their health insurance connector was a part, one of the major things that they did was to merge their non-group and small employer group markets. They established a requirement that employers with more than 10 full-time equivalent employees must set up a Section 125 plan. That's the mechanism that would allow their employees to pay for their health insurance premiums on a pre-tax basis. They established an individual mandate, so everyone in the state has to have health insurance coverage, and that mandate went into effect on July 1st of this year. They established a fair share employer assessment and a free rider surcharge as ways to promote employer responsibility as well as individual responsibility in health insurance reform. They established the health insurance connector, which I will talk about in more detail in a moment. This program is also called Commonwealth Choice, and it is run through the Health Insurance Connector Authority. There's another program that's also run through the Health Insurance Connector Authority, which is a sliding scale subsidized coverage for people who aren't eligible for public subsidies, so their Medicaid program, and who also don't have access to employer subsidized insurance. That program is also run through the Health Insurance Connector Authority. The Health Insurance Connector Authority is run by a board of about 10 individuals, four of whom are state agency heads, three of whom are appointed by the governor, and three of whom are appointed by legislators. It does do a number of things beyond the pure health insurance exchange concept. As I mentioned a moment ago, it administers the Commonwealth Care Program, and what they had to do to set up that program, they had to establish some sliding scale premium subsidies. They had to decide what would be in the benefit set for that program, and they had to make decisions about who could sell coverage and who could buy it. It also administers the Commonwealth Choice Program, which is the part of this proposal that is most similar to what was proposed in Minnesota this past year, which is exclusively, this is the private market program, offers a limited number of products with a state seal of approval to individuals and small employer groups. It allows for the payment of insurance premiums with pre-tax dollars. And inside of the health insurance connector in Massachusetts, there are six carriers offering coverage. Each of those carriers offers seven plan choices, including two plans that are specifically designed for the young adult population. The carriers bid to participate in the connector, and the connector certifies the plans as having high value and good quality. Individuals and businesses with 50 or fewer employees can buy coverage through the connector, but they do not have to buy coverage through the connector. So the connector operates in parallel with the existing private insurance market. But in both cases, the non-group market and the small employer group market are merged. There are no direct subsidies for purchases of coverage through the Commonwealth Choice product, but as noted earlier, premiums are paid on a pre-tax basis, and so there is actually an implicit tax subsidy for those policies. What the Health Insurance Connector Authority does, it's responsible for collecting premiums from employers and subsidies from the state for that Commonwealth Care product, and it passes the premium payments along to health plans. It established the Commonwealth Care benefits package, the cost-sharing requirements, and premium schedules, and it negotiated payment rates with health plans and also performs a very large outreach and awareness function because of the requirement that all individuals in Massachusetts have health insurance coverage. It's been very important to do a very large outreach and awareness campaign. The Health Insurance Connector Authority hired a contractor to do a variety of functions that one might think of as typically things that would be performed by health plans themselves. So they're doing customer service, enrollment, premium billing and collection, interacting with brokers, employers, individuals, and health plans for both the Commonwealth Care and Commonwealth Choice products. Those activities are funded by a 4% assessment on premiums, and my understanding is that the 4% assessment is based on the rationale that the connector is doing things and replacing expenses that would otherwise be paid for by health plans. So health plans' expenses will be reduced, and that the amount of money being spent on those functions is not 4% higher than before, but it is actually a replacement of one person doing that for another person doing that. Finally, the Health Insurance Connector Authority had responsibility for establishing standards for what it means to meet the state's individual mandate. So what kind of coverage must you have in order to meet the individual health insurance mandate, and establish standards for affordability, because there is an exception to the individual mandate where people who do not have access to coverage that is considered are affordable will be exempt from the mandate. So just very quickly, I wanted to talk about the characteristics of the Massachusetts market prior to reform. In their individual market, they had guaranteed issue, which we do not have in Minnesota. They allowed premium variation on age and geography only. So in other words, premiums were not based on a person's health status. There was very little choice of health plans. There were two standard plans that were offered and a single carrier that had over 90% share of the market. Enrollment in terms of the population of the state was very small, so it was about 0.7% of the population and declining prior to the merger with the small group market. And premium costs were very high. Depending on which of the two plans you chose, premiums were averaging between $5,000 and $8,000 per year per person. The small group market in Massachusetts prior to reform includes the self-employed, which is different from Minnesota, where our small group market includes employers of size 2 to 50. They have guaranteed issue, but again, premiums are not allowed to vary based on health status. They do vary based on age, geography, industry, and group size. The rate bands in Massachusetts were much tighter than what we have in Minnesota, so they have a 2-to-1 rate band, whereas effectively what we have is a 5-to-1 ratio if you take into account the variations allowed in Minnesota for age, health status, and other factors. And in Massachusetts, enrollment in the small group market was nearly 11% of the population. That's higher than we have in Minnesota as a share of our population. Most likely a fair amount of that is due to the fact that they have allowed the self-employed into this market as well. So just to conclude, there are some very specific reasons, I think, behind the ways that the reforms in Massachusetts were constructed. So, for example, the non-group market appeared to be in very serious trouble. It had shrunk to very, very low enrollment, very high cost, and they were really looking for a solution that would improve affordability in the non-group market. And, in fact, this merger of the non-group and small group markets in Minnesota was intended, or it was believed, that it would reduce premiums in the non-group market by as much as 25%, but there was very explicit recognition of the fact that premiums in the small group market would rise as a result, but because the small group market is so much bigger, it was anticipated that that increase would be about 2 to 3%, but that was a very explicit decision made by Massachusetts policymakers. That's my quick 10-minute overview of the Health Insurance Connector. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions that you might have.
I don't know if you can answer this, and I'm expecting probably not, but one of the things that I've always wondered about is after they got the exchange set up, for people who are above 300% of poverty, because that was their cutoff, was the individual products that came forward taking into account the tax break that someone would get affordable for the age group of people 50 to 65 years old?
Madam
Chair, because, I mean, you know, they're mandating you have coverage, and it would seem to me like you would need to know whether the age group for whom health insurance is usually the least affordable, whether your connector products were going to work for them.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, you're correct. I don't have that answer, but we can certainly get the answer to that question for you.
Further questions? Okay, thank you. Okay. The last thing on the agenda, and we'll take, you know, we'll take some time to go through this, because I think it's an important step here as we move to the next stage of this, is to have a discussion just among the members here about affordability based on some of the presentations we've had and information collected. I think
getting people's reactions, but mostly with an eye to giving guidance to the staff and others as to how we come up with a recommendation to the full Healthcare Access Commission on the issue of affordability. So it is, I think the discussion can be as broad-ranging as people want. What would the components of such a proposal be? What are your reactions to the discussions we've had so far? How specific or narrow should this be? All those kind of things, I think, would be appropriate. So if anybody wants to start out on a discussion of what you have in mind when we're kind of talking about a recommendation of affordability, floor is open.
Mr. Chairman, let me just give you an example, because I've had people ask me questions about this issue of affordability, and they'll say things like, when you talk about affordability, are you just going to be talking about premiums, or are you also going to be talking about deductibles and other out-of-pocket costs? And really, I don't know. I mean, it depends on what people decide they think we should be looking for. Obviously, at some level, you get deductibles and out-of-pockets that clearly make a health insurance product not desirable for certain income groups to achieve. But, would we take it to the point where we would count every out-of-pocket cost toward the definition of affordability?
One, I would agree that I think the issue of that premiums and out-of-pockets, my opinion would be is that we need to figure out some kind of combination of those, because you can clearly get affordable premiums and have really, have $5,000 deductible plans, which really aren't going to provide adequate coverage. I would also just like to offer up that I think that, one sort of touchstone on the issue of affordability is not only the cost of it, but sort of what people are getting for the cost, what the coverage is. And one way that we've been thinking about it is this idea that we should be able to, at least I think we should be able to offer a certain degree of protection from medical debt from the insurance coverage. So it would be a combination of how much people are paying out as well as what they're covered for. Because if we do limited coverage sets that are affordable, they're only really good for what you're getting covered for, and if you end up with a disease or an accident or something that's not covered under your limited benefit set, you're still going to be forced to come up with the money somehow. And the whole issue of medical debt, I think, is pretty critical. I mean, if we're going to go through the trouble of figuring out how to insure Minnesotans, it would be good if part of that was that people no longer had to worry about getting sick and going into debt because they're sick.
Mr. Benner.
Thank you.
How do people want to be addressed? You want to be Mr., or would people be a
Pete is James? Just fine.
All right. I'm going to do that then. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To follow up on Holly's comment, we see the PowerPoint slides that talk about the distribution of healthcare costs, and the 20% using 80% of the care, the top 1% using whatever the number is. When you look at a group and look at how out-of-pockets fall, they fall exactly the same way. And when you look at the studies that say the average out-of-pocket cost is, that's one of these almost totally useless pieces of information, because you only have a handful of people that are at the average. Most of us who are fortunate to not need much health care, we might get $20 or $30 at an office visit once or twice a year. If you have a prescription or two, it's whatever the drug copay is. But if you get to $100, $150 a year, that's it for the vast majority of the people. When you remember, 50% of the folks use 3% of the care. I mean, most people never have an out-of-pocket or have minimal out-of-pocket events. Then you got the folks that are actually sick. And depending on how a health plan defines its out-of-pocket maxes and how it defines its deductibles and co-insurances and co-pays, somebody can get to $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $10,000 bucks with amazing speed, depending upon how that benefit set is designed. You know, just looking at the state employee group, you know, we went through a stage in the 80s and 90s when we moved to classic HMO benefits. And the out-of-pockets were so low that the issue of out-of-pocket maxes became irrelevant for all practical purposes because you couldn't get there. But as that HMO model, we backed away from it, what everyone did is you started to layer on the deductibles and the copays, and all of a sudden we found that people who actually got sick were getting hit with, you know, depending on your plan design again, fairly substantial out-of-pockets. Lewin and Company did a study earlier this year for the Wisconsin reform model, trying to figure out what would Wisconsin save money or not on this. And for whatever reasons, they were asked to design or to cost out a HSA model plan, which would have a deductible and then some amount of HSA contribution. They had to factor in a bad debt component that this model would increase the uncompensated care to providers because of how they did the benefit design. And, I don't see anyone having designed benefit sets that take into account the out-of-pocket costs relative to any sort of relationship to income. The public programs do, but you get outside the public programs in the insured market or in the self-insured market, and there is not a model to go from. But I think it's very important that we do the work here to figure out how you begin to design a model that just doesn't define affordability based upon premium. I mean, the health plans have done a very good job at that. We've told them that's an important thing to do, and they've done that. We've not told them, however, that you need to cap out-of-pocket exposure. And, you know, if you look at the Blues website for the individual market, you can know precisely how much it will cost you to buy an individual product at various deductible levels and out-of-pocket levels from the Blues. And you can get really low monthly premiums, even at, or I should maybe at the point you hit some of our ages, you can't. But for, you know, people under 40, you can get reasonably low premiums if you're willing to pay a high enough deductible. But if you're a family that's making $20,000 a year, maybe you can afford the premium, but can you take the risk to have a $5,000 or $6,000 medical event come back on you? And I expect most people at that income level can't afford to take that risk. So we wind up with folks that are that don't have insurance. And this is a hard issue for us to grapple with, but I think it's very important that we come up in January with a set of recommendations as to how you can design products that in fact protect people or that tie people's out-of-pockets or out-of-pockets plus premium to their capacity to pay.
Any further ideas? Anybody kind of on the health plan side? Or, well, go ahead.
I was just going to comment on something that Pete brought up, because I think part of what you described there is some of the decisions that people make that shift the cost. So somebody all of a sudden ends up with a premium change that they don't like, so they choose to go without, which then shifts who's bearing that cost. Which is why in our Healthy Minnesota efforts, we did recommend a mandate of sorts, which is probably the single most controversial piece that came over. But at any rate, I think you need some way to set in stone pretty much how those costs are going to be distributed. If you design a system that allows those to be bounced back and forth all over the place, it's really kind of the non-system that we have now. And so I think that as we decide where we need to land, we need to be very careful about where those costs are going to be apportioned, so that every time we make a change, it doesn't just knock the dominoes down and move it all.
Mr. Chairman, I am assuming that the charge that's given to this working group in terms of affordability and, to some extent, product design is with the idea in mind that if we were going to do a mandate, what would we consider to be affordable for people who would then be required to purchase a product? Because, I mean, otherwise, you know, we have the emergency room system. Not that that's the most value-based system for the healthcare expenditures we make as a collective group, but for some individuals, it may be the smartest way for them to access healthcare at this time because we don't provide much alternative.
Right, but I don't think that's what we had in mind when we talked about having universal coverage, because the access to that health care certainly isn't what you and I would want for our care. We have in our emergency room, which is the busiest in the state, an average length of stay of almost 3 days for patients who are there for mental health reasons. That's in the emergency room. Mm-hmm. It's not even an inpatient ward. That's outpatient in the ED, in the acute psychiatric center. So that's not kind of what we're looking for in all this, but that is what happens when it defaults to a system like that where there is some place to go, but without the thought put into how do we appropriately incentivize where care should be provided and how do we appropriately provide for where patients are best cared for. But I was very impressed, and I'm certainly not the right person to be addressing the affordability issue, but I was impressed with some of the literature that you shared with the group on the California work on affordability. And it looked to me like the very same kind of analysis they did needs to be done on our state, because it looks like there's tremendous variability community by community, because really it's the balance of how much it costs to live before health care, and in the cost of health care really gets the baseline. And as there's tremendous variation, even within our own state, the cost of living as you go around the state, there's probably a different answer to the affordability issue from community to community in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, the affordability issue, you know, when we think about it as far as extending coverage, getting coverage to more people, I think we absolutely want to do that, and though I think we need to do it carefully and always be thinking about the hidden effects of what we choose to do. For example, the Massachusetts program, taking 4% of premiums to fund the connector as an insurance vehicle, in some ways creates another organization and won't completely eliminate 4% of cost from where it came. And so in some ways, without necessarily funding any more care, they may have added a half or 1 or 2% administrative cost onto a system already burdened. So I think we always sort of need to think about the backside of what we do. I can't help but think about affordability and think about cost, too, because to make it more affordable and to extend. And I know that's not our primary concern, but as we think about benefit design, healthy people use less health care. And so either for the group we're addressing as under or uninsured and more broadly, to think more about the incentives and some of the incentives we talked about today, value-based benefits for people to pursue programs that help them to make better choices, to see providers who are more efficient and maybe better coaches than other providers, or willing to bring in people other than doctors who are better coaches, and how we look at those supply-sensitive services and what we do to sort of get care closer to that evidence base as we look at all of it. I struggle to separate the two.
Further thoughts on this issue, or, you know, I mean, I think that there's you know, other pieces that we've heard about, you know, whether it would make sense to put in place some kind
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I think it's important we have the discussion as to what affordability means. We may well conclude we can't get there in 2008 or 2009 or 2010 because of things we can't control, but a starting point that says here's where we're trying to get. I mean, we set a goal that said we want to have everybody insured by 2011. I think we can likewise set goals saying we want health care not to cost a family more than X, and that may be sliding scale, that may be same percent for everybody, that may be sliding scale. I think that's a discussion we can have. But I think we do great good to the general debate about what health care reform is about by trying to help this community come to some consensus as to what that is. Because I think that helps put pressure on everybody else that's a player to know that here's where we're trying to get to. And if we have to do it in steps, we have to do it in steps. But we get an agreement that it is as to what that might be.
And and that's actually interesting, because what I'm hearing you're talking about is affordability, not kind of at the individual level necessarily, but also at a more macro level about what's affordable to pay for health care in Minnesota.
I mean, Mr. Chairman, I don't think we successfully. I would feel very good if we have an individual definition. My guess is if we're serious about health reform, we have to be willing to make some of the decisions that Senator Berglund and her gang of whatever it was made when we did the reform efforts in the early 90s, where we said we have serious targets on rate of growth. We have serious targets on what that overall percentage of payment has to be. If we're concerned, for example, about keeping employers in this game, and we set up a system where the employers have to continue to pay another 10%, another 10%, another 10% every year, we've answered our question about whether we're going to put an end to employer erosion. We will see that. What was the number we saw this morning?
67%.
67%. We'll just see that going down a couple points every year unless we also make this affordable to employers.
57.
Yeah.
57. What's the number?
Yeah.
57. 67.
Senator Berglund.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we did hand out at one of our earlier meetings a premium schedule for Minnesota Care-like programs in Minnesota and then in other states. And when I looked at it, it looked like we were pretty much in the ballpark. The only state that does something a little bit different than most is Washington State, which does do some rating based on age in their public program. And so then it's kind of hard to compare, but, with Minnesota Care, if we had a program that went to 300% of poverty, we don't. But if we did, you'd be getting into the around the 9% of income range for your premiums with pretty minimal other out-of-pocket costs. And, I don't know if people consider that reasonable and, can you go up further from that? So people who are at 400% of poverty, you could expect 12% of their. I mean, you realize as their income goes up, the percentage takes a larger amount also. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question, but we do know that our Minnesota Care clients are price sensitive. When the premiums were raised, we saw pretty dramatic erosion of take-up in the program. So we think now we're back to where we were before, that we're maybe a little closer to being right.
I think that because what we're looking at is we hope going to be a moving target as we get better at reducing the total cost of providing the necessary health care that we would like to get, even if we choose to distribute some of it appropriately to underserved services such as behavioral health, mental health issues. Because that's a moving target, I think we have to be careful as we redesign the changes as to who is going to kind of bear the cost of that transition. And what I'm afraid of in this discussion is if you too tightly define affordability, you're putting at risk our most vulnerable population for the changes that we need to make, rather than carrying that financial risk where it might be borne a little more readily. So if we don't adequately define affordable and put a lot of patients at risk because we're saying this is the best we can do at this time, you may not be able to get health care, but this is the best we can do, because we have been unable to reduce our costs fast enough or through government and private entities bear the cost. If you understand what I mean here, if the decision point is at that, what is the cutoff level? What is the percentage of income that we're going to define that? I'm not sure that's necessarily the right way to go about deciding where to be, because I think that at least what I read out there would suggest it's a good bit more than 300% of poverty level for some areas where that affordability point is going to be. By the time you add in the cost of their premiums and the cost of their out-of-pocket expenses. So we're going to be making some decisions as to who to put at risk for our definition.
So you're saying that under the definition, to get any product that would be at that price, you're going to have to eliminate certain services?
Well, I guess as a physician, my view of a conservative choice for affordability would be a definition that's higher than I think policymakers might otherwise choose, controlling costs.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that's been crossing my mind is chronic disease, and as one of the people that's a provider on this table, I'm thinking back of the presentation, two previous presentations, and we're doing a good job, but we're not there yet. And I'll give you the example that I had the experience over the summer with, and that is I brought up a little girl from Peru to have a valve replacement done for her heart. And it was a wonderful experience because I got to see my system from a very different perspective. And it was wonderful because they had no idea who I was. And so I could just sit there and be a vegetable in a good way. But one of the things I learned at the university that we do really well, and it's very similar to what we've seen on diabetes, what we've seen in heart disease, is in our Coumadin clinic. And we've taken our population of Coumadin clinic people, which is over 700 people, and we now monitor them every 3 days instead of having them come in. And it's for all sort of blood disease types. And I'm just giving you a small example, but it really resonated with me this summer that we have these chronic diseases that we're very aware of. And how can we do better as providers in managing these cares and stopping the process up front and making sure those people don't go back into the hospital? And the cost savings that I saw, even with this little girl, were astronomical because we were able to control her INRs perfectly because we brought her in on the front end and not on the back end. And I just think there's a lot of cost savings there and that we got to keep capturing them. And I don't know what they all are, but they're there, and we've got to find them. And we need your help. And I think we're doing a better job in working with the health plans and creating them and setting up the right sort of protocols. And that's a tough one for providers. But I think we're going to have to go there more and more. And I just thank you for the excellent presentations. Now it's the right way to think.
Thank you. I thought they were great as well.
I was just thinking that, I mean, I think another way that we may want to think about this affordability thing is not, and I might have misunderstood what you were saying, but there's one way of thinking about it, which is sort of what we can afford based on what the current costs are, and starting at that point. So if we, you know, if we're going to kind of cap people's expenses at the affordability level of whatever it's going to be, then how much less are we going to provide to them because we've you know, said this is what's affordable. And I would just want to challenge all of us to maybe flip that the other way around, which is if, I don't know if this is going to come out exactly right, but if sort of if this is what we can afford and what we expect out of that is better health, I think it also begins to beg the question that some of the investments need to go other places than strictly into the most expensive care that we have, which is in the acute care system. So I think that part of the affordability discussion needs to sort of challenge sort of our expectations of the entire sort of health system as opposed to just the medical system, if that's making any sense. Because I think that if we limit what's affordable to what we can actually afford under the current system with the amount of costs that are driving that system, I think we're going to fail because it's not going to be sustainable. And the question's then going to become, okay, if we're going to limit people at 8% of their income, but all you're going to get for 8% of your income is your preventative costs and some other stuff, and if you end up running over that, well, sorry about that. You know, so I just think that we need to challenge that the affordability question needs to challenge a lot more of our thinking than simply, you know, sort of rationing on this side of it and thinking more about, well, what is it in the acute care system that has to be done differently? I mean, I think the presentation today on the whole issue of variation is critical. I mean, that really is what we need to get at, and that's not driven by, you know, what I'm paying out of pocket. That's driven by how docs practice medicine. So I think that there's a lot of additional challenges out there, but that we shouldn't that those questions need to get asked as well as simply saying, well, we can really only afford so much based on the system, and it's the best we can do, and, you know, try to stay healthy sort of thing.
Mr. Chairman, I tend to think of it as a goal. I don't think of it as, well, you can only afford 8% of your income to be spent on your health insurance, so you only get, you know, A, B, and forget about C, D, and E part of the package. I think of it as a goal as to if we're creating a system, what do we believe is a fair share for an individual based on their income to contribute toward their health care? And, of course, today we've got some people who maybe could afford to contribute to their health care. They don't contribute anything. We've got other people who maybe are, you know, really struggling and contributing way more than we would think is reasonable for them to be responsible citizen in terms of meeting their health care needs. So that's what I think of it as a goal of what we think is a reasonable contribution for an individual or a family based on their income to make toward meeting their own health care needs.
Well, I think it's a really interesting way to think about it, but it also sort of begins to maybe beg the question of whether looking at it that way is whether thinking about what the premium costs and the out-of-pocket costs are the way to measure what people can afford to contribute. I mean, sort of, I mean, you could sort of take that idea of, you know, people contributing what they can, you know, what they really can afford in order to get the health care that they end up needing, that there's a whole different mechanism to do that than thinking about individual plans and premium costs. I mean, maybe I don't want to take this too far afield, but I mean, the idea that, you know, if you're looking at a broad-based progressive tax system to fund a healthcare system, that is certainly a way to think about how people contribute based on their ability to pay that's not tied to, you know, what a premium cost in a health plan is. You know, I mean, I does that make
say a little bit more about that.
Well, if the idea is that, you know, if people need to contribute based on their ability to pay for what health care they need, I mean, a way to do it, and I'm not necessarily saying this is the way to do it, but a way to do it is some kind of publicly funded system that people pay into based on their ability, you know, based on their ability to pay. And that from that, they then, you know, then there's a healthcare system that's built around that, that's funded by that, that then provides the care that people need when they need the care.
Senator Berlin.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that the charge we were given was to figure out how it should be purchased necessarily. I think the charge we were given was to figure out However you purchase it, what is a reasonable amount of a contribution that an individual should be required or asked to make toward health care? And I think it's just, I mean, I think we're trying to maybe get it way more complicated than it needs to be, but, you know, if you figure that out and you say, well, okay, that gives you this amount of money, and in order to have what we consider an appropriate level of care, you need this amount of money, then you've got an amount that you can figure out is the difference that you need to subsidize. And you can then, you know, see if you can find cost savings or find ways to bring money in to meet that goal. And if not, then, you know, do you adjust what you think is affordable or do you adjust what you think people should be able to receive, or what do you do? But it's so basic question of a target for what we think should be the amount that people contribute toward their own health care. And maybe we think if you're sicker, you should contribute more than if you're not. I don't know, but I think it's that simple.
Well, go ahead. Yes,
well,
thank you.
I just think the other way to think about that is not to link those two issues quite so closely, that what we're really after is the best health care we can provide, meaning we're providing the right thing and just the right thing, not more or less of it, at the best possible cost we can so that the value is maximized. From that, you get what the total cost for health care in this country is or should be. And from there, you can have the discussion about how you apportion the cost. So as we decide at any one point in time what some individual might bear or what the total cost of the state of Minnesota might be able to bear, again, that's a moving target that I think most of us feel should be one that at least trends down over time compared to where it is right now. But I think that if, you know, you can come up with a formula right now that says it, but that formula might not be right in 2 years or 3 years or 4 years. So it would be nice to know the principles upon which you decide where that is. What is affordable for the individual? What is affordable for us collectively of all the players in the system? Labor, the government.
What principles would you...
Well, I think that among those principles that you have to go back to is I think most Americans, most Minnesotans feel that the access to high-quality health care is a right, that we have an obligation to make it available. I think most people believing that, then, it really is incumbent on us to decide what of all those things we do in health care is that right, is necessary. And I think that those of us in healthcare can easily recognize a lot of things we do that perhaps aren't so necessary. Perhaps not even because somebody has made a conscious decision to do something wrong, but we've certainly incentivized many things that are driving us in the wrong directions. We talked a little bit briefly about the cost of medical facilities and hospital beds and technology advancement and all those things. And there is a real cost savings over time for some of those, but there's a real cost for which we never gain savings for others. And perhaps one of those things we need to balance is how rapidly we move forward buying new technology and new facilities versus what the affordability to any individual is.
Well, again, I just ask you to think about it this way, because you're trying to answer more than one question at a time, and
right.
And I have a feeling that if we're trying to answer more than one question at a time, not that the other questions don't need to also be answered, but that if we're trying to answer more than one question at a time, we're never going to get any question answered at all.
Well, the point I was trying to make is that if we're going to answer the question of what is affordable, we can't do it until we've defined what that health care is that we feel we need to provide.
But let's just assume for the moment we're talking about a system where people only are going to expect to get and are only going to receive what is medically necessary based on evidence, then how much should they pay of their income toward that care?
I wish I knew that, because that isn't what people expect right now.
Let's just say if. I mean, I'm assuming in this question that that's what the Healthcare Access Commission would say we should be paying for. We shouldn't be paying for the other 30 to 50% of what we talked about today might not be needed. But if that was what we were paying for, you still have the question of what is my responsibility toward meeting my health care, and that would vary based on various individuals. Obviously, at a state level, we made a decision that at a certain income level, you're eligible for the Medicaid program, and you don't have to pay a premium. And then we've done sort of a sliding scale for people that have more income than that, but still maybe can't afford to go out and buy an individual insurance product on the market today. We need to get the system right-sized, but we also need to understand what is a reasonable amount for an individual to contribute toward their own care. Because by its very nature, when we say, well, we want affordable care for everyone, well, what does affordable mean? That's kind of an important component.
Senator, do you have a thought as to really know this issue so well, and it sounds like you might have a thought as
to what you had to know? Well, I don't know, but I do know that the materials we handed out, the studies that were done both in Massachusetts and in California, indicate that they did not believe that people at or below 300% of poverty could just be thrown out to the private insurance market and said, and be told, you have to go buy a comprehensive product on your own. That there was an expectation that there'd be some level of subsidy up to that point. And in some states, they've gone beyond that and said, not only that, but up to 400% of poverty, you don't get a subsidy, but you get the benefit of buying in to whatever the group product is that we're offering for people with a subsidy. So you have a choice of buying that product or buying a private insurance product. Now, of course, you know, you're probably going to have some anti-selection in that going on, but in the name of affordability, there are some states that have said that. And then there are some states that have created these connectors to give people more tax advantages in order to, you know, use our tax dollars differently to create another form of subsidy at the individual market level. And in Massachusetts, they kept telling us their goal was about 8.8%, not more than 8.8% of income should be required to be contributed. I'm not sure that they're actually making it with every age group, but that was on average what they were looking at. But we might decide it should be more or maybe a little less or something like that. I don't know.
Dr. Fazio, I think.
Charlie, it's okay.
Charlie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize if we have this already, but do we have the information on the income percentage at which people began to drop coverage when premiums went up? And I didn't come having looked at this ahead of time, but won't make that mistake for next week. But the sort of the affordability levels and then the level at which people started to drop, I think, would be useful guides.
Yeah, we could get you what our schedule was previous to this year when we raised it. And, you know, we didn't raise it dramatically. I mean, we raised it, well, I think it was, we did not raise it on children, I don't believe. We raised it on adults, and I think it was about 5%. And it had a pretty dramatic effect on people dropping coverage. Right. But we can get you that.
So I'd be curious where those are. And then I guess the second part of my thoughts goes back to the issue of incentives. I think at the point where we identify some fair level, we should think about reducing that level for people who are active participants in programs like we've heard about today,
mm-hmm.
and maybe even in existing programs. Because, again, if we get back to how do we find more savings so it becomes affordable for more people, it's getting to those issues about supply-sensitive care and to issues about personal choices and what those do to drive costs.
I think, Pete, did you have your hand up?
Yeah.
Pete, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't see the discussion we're trying to have around individual affordability in the world we have today is incompatible with, Don, with where you're trying to, I think, get at in terms of the broader stuff. The default affordability mechanism we have now is either for insurers to find a different way of slicing and dicing the individual in the small group market that makes the premium more affordable for some subset of people, but the price of that is it becomes less affordable for another subset of people. But that's the tool we've given them, so that's what they do. You look in the employed market, and whether this is a union negotiating with an employer or just a benefits manager trying to work this thing through with their executive committee, the tools we have today are, well, we can try to reslice our definition of family.
Yes.
So instead of having a single rate cell for family, we'll now have spouse or adult plus kid or kids to make it more affordable for one subset, but that immediately makes it less affordable for traditional families with two spouses and who adhere to the Lord's commandment to propagate. So we've just moved it again. As I watched the debate last session between the various efforts to make care more affordable for some people, it struck me there was no standard against which any of these proposals could be measured in terms of where we get the best bang for the buck in terms of who the subsidies, whatever amount they were going to be, would go to. And it was going to be, I think, absolute luck if the subsidies at the end of the day went to the people who had currently the biggest reach to make in terms of making health care affordable for themselves and their families, just like it is with all the other ways we do this. And part of my hope on a definition is that it will start to discipline some of the rest of the debate, especially on the near and midterm reforms, that it doesn't let us get away by saying, well, we've made it more affordable for you simply by shifting the cost somewhere else within the world, because they're going to show up on that model also. I will leave it at that.
Just wanted to share, thank you, Mr. Chairman, some of the challenges we had in looking at this in terms of percent of income. And I think we concluded that for our own organization, that approach probably was not going to be as helpful, because we could model numerous scenarios that all depended on what the benefit packages looked like. But importantly, to your point, Pete, in looking at it, it does have to account for the out-of-pocket expenses, the claims costs, and the premiums, and sort of add all of that together. So then you get the factor of utilization in there. But the swing is so much from it could be 9% for this package, but there might be huge provider write-offs in the case of Minnesota Care, where providers are writing off hospital costs. For commercial packages, it depended on what it was. You know, if you had a skinny package envisioned, such as maybe something that was going to be offered in Massachusetts, that affordability index looks really different than the federal employees package. So I think it gets down, we've decided that it probably gets down to more what is the benefit package going to look like will determine a lot of the affordability. Is it evidence-based care? Is it medically necessary care? But that's a tough part of the debate, because the affordability percent by income looks vastly different based on what you're modeling it on. So our construct was more to move toward some of the things that Mark has talked about today. We're reporting to our board on what are we doing to impact affordability in all of those types of programs, because that's where the energy needs to go. I think the challenge maybe for us, too, is how do we bring more of those programs in line in working in partnership more with the state so that people who are enrolled in state public programs have access to that kind of, the state has access to those sort of programs that could impact cost. And that's talking about the healthy lifestyles. How do we make those kinds of programs relevant and meaningful for people who are in state public programs, accessible for those? But we found there wasn't one secret sauce, but looking at it purely as a percent of income was kind of limiting what was behind the scene in terms of impacting affordability, because the benefit packages swung so much that we were modeling.
Tara.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Thank you. I wanted to say something about what Charlie was talking about with personal incentive. I think whatever we kind of come up with here as a group, I'm sure everybody knows somebody. Like, I have an uncle who's he's diabetic. He's an alcoholic and he smokes. And I think that whatever we kind of come up with here, there has to be personal incentives for people to change their behavior, to have better lifestyles, because that is definitely going that's going to help with bringing costs down for everybody. So just want to reiterate what Charlie was saying.
Well, one of the things that I'm kind of, at least that I'm picking up, is that there's a discussion here, a tension here between looking at kind of how much a person can afford for a certain kind of benefit set, and there's going to be variation based on what we decide a benefit set is. And so what's the chicken and what's the egg, I guess. Mm-hmm. Do people feel comfortable, though? One of the things I think Senator Berglund was raising was this notion of there's affordability for what perhaps we would consider kind of a medical, whatever, value-based or medically necessary or some type of benefits that we think everybody ought to have. And then is there another level of affordability that we look at beyond that for other things people want to get? And maybe that varies depending on whether you're under a certain percentage of poverty or not, because it becomes less affordable to get those extras. But how do people feel about that kind of, first of all, am I picking up correctly on that tension that I'm hearing here, and is that a way to kind of talk about it a different way? Does that make sense? Pete.
Well, I think there's actually a third component to that. There's a question of what is the benefit set, and the value of the work that folks are starting to do on what is a value evidence-based benefit set. The idea that would be that there is that benefit set does provide all medically necessary care, which I think is our concern, but it doesn't provide care that is nice to have, or at least not as part of a core set. So you have a benefit set question. And yes, the reaching an affordability goal to me ought to be tied to a core benefit set. It also depends on where you go. The cost variation among providers in Minnesota is significant. I know I just see an article in the paper. Medica has now rolled out a product that is tied to what it has identified as lower cost providers. The state employee benefit set tiers based upon cost. But within the state, there's about a 70% variation in risk-adjusted per member per month cost. And if you're going to tie affordability to people going to only the highest cost providers, that will get you to a very different definition than if that is tied to going to lower cost quality providers. Do we have the data yet to validate quality on all this? No, we do not. But my guess is it is not. The people at the top of the 70% are not the highest quality, at least not on everything. And the people at the bottom of that 70% are quality on at least some stuff. And so to me, it also would be valid that we say, if choices people make to go to a provider who costs more but cannot demonstrate a quality difference, that kind of is exempt from the protection. And that's a valid, that's a choice people can make on their own. Will that have a differential impact on people that make more and make less? Yes, it will. You know, people in the top 10% of the income profile will have a lot more choices on providers than people at the bottom end. But my goal, at least for the type of people we've represented, you know, and that's $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year families, we're trying to get affordable health care for them. And right now they can't get it in many of our contracts or even some of our contracts. You know, well, yeah, they can't get it. And I'm more than happy to engage in a discussion that balances, you know, a benefit set and provider choices as long as we can verify that the providers in the group are quality. In return for a commitment that healthcare will be affordable for them.
Kind of picking up on what you said, I mean, in your experience in negotiating some of these things, I mean, what, when you're thinking of a $20,000 or $30,000 or $50,000 family, and what is affordable to them in terms of, is that a question that you could kind of shed some light on? I mean, because you said that you're finding that these aren't affordable. What is it, where is it that it's not affordable? And
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to claim that we have thought that out rigorously. I think it tends to be unfortunately done from the other way, that as the cost numbers come in as to what that is going to mean in premium share next year versus wage increases versus out of pockets, you make decisions which are not optimal. Case by case, in every different round of this discussion. And as I said, I think benefit managers and unorganized firms have the same set of discussions with their presidents or CEOs. This year we put our emphasis on minimizing the percent of premium increase. Next year we make a decision based upon minimizing changes in out-of-pockets or trying to hold down the out-of-pocket maximum. Another year, and I think in state bargaining this time, it was people were demanding wage increases. And so decisions got made to increase out-of-pockets that, you know, that in a different round in COBRA that would not have been made in a different round. And I would, as a practitioner, I would like, it would help me to actually have the discipline of saying it ought to be, you know, 5% or 7% or 8% or whatever it is, because I would behave differently at the bargaining table. And I think benefit managers would behave differently in their work if you were tying that to a standard.
We did ask the question this year during the session for those who are at 275% of poverty or less families. If their employer was requiring them to pay either premium contributions and or deductibles and co-payments that was more than 10% of their income, could we justify that they might need a subsidy to purchase that employer coverage? And the answer we got back is we would be picking up state employees.
Yeah.
Because there are state employees whose families are less than 275% of poverty paying more than 10%.
My guess is the affordability answer would be quite different for somebody living and working in Hibbing than would be living and working in Minneapolis.
Well, we didn't get that.
The variation in a California study for a single parent family of three was like $42,000-some-odd. Would require subsidization across the state at about the 300% level. But it really varied whether they lived in San Diego or lived up in Eureka or something like that.
Yeah, we didn't get into that level of detail with it. They said, well, you're going to then be needing to pick up state employees. So we said, okay, we won't do copays. How about just premiums and deductibles? At 10%.
Yeah.
Dr. Charlie.
Mr. Chair, four random but related thoughts, sort of. I like the thought that it would be nice to steer people to efficient providers. It's part of what I was talking about earlier with sort of some of the less evidence-based care, and yet I'm afraid we're talking about people for whom mobility and transportation is an issue, so that might be a barrier to that kind of a product set. The notion that we're always robbing from one pool to pay another. If more people come into the programs as they currently exist and are funded, providers will complain that this is more business that doesn't cover their costs, and so there will be more pressure on existing commercial customers to help subsidize this as we look at it. Back to your original question about benefit sets, I've always assumed that insurance shouldn't pay for things that were sort of elective, and always had a discomfort with tiers of benefit sets otherwise as we look at sort of a basic set of necessary services, because it's not clear to me what you'd take out of medically appropriate services when you defined that benefit set. And so I think that would take a lot of discussion to get to that point. And then lastly, related to that, we might have to work on our terms as we go forward. You know, the insurance also often says we'll pay for medically necessary care, that's you can't define every single thing that you're going to pay for. But medically necessary, based on efficiency measures, is 70% more in some offices than in other offices. So what is covered versus what is nice to have versus what is medically necessary will vary as we talk about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're talking about an affordability standard for everybody, right, not just the state program.
I was just going to raise that question to make sure that where people are on that. I mean, there's the state employees and the public programs, however we deal with that. But I was also assuming that my assumption was that we're maybe talking about affordability for other folks as well, depending on what kind of program we set up. But is that where people are on the group here?
Mm-hmm. For everybody.
Okay.
And then to that, I mean, I also hope that sort of going back to Senator Berglund's point about sort of thinking about a goal and then figuring out how we get to the goal, that for this process, that the goal not be set too high, too low, based on the pragmatic thing of what we can actually afford. I mean, the discussion around sort of keeping the premiums tied to what you're getting. I mean, getting the affordability tied to what benefits that you get. I mean, clearly that's a piece of it. But I think the senator's point early on, which is sort of like what's a reasonable amount for people to pay to get the health care that they need? I guess I'd be more comfortable if we move back to that piece of the conversation, because I think when we start tying it to what you get for what you're paying for, it just gets too, not complicated, but it gets too, you start bringing in too much other stuff that we may or may not be able to control, and I would really hate to see us get to a standard that comes out of this process where we look back in a year and realize that we have just sort of defined, you know, a whole class of underinsured Minnesotans because of it, you know. So, I mean, I just hope that while we might not get there right away, I hope that coming out of this process is that it really is sort of a free and clear conversation about what is reasonable for people to be paying for the health care that they need. And then sort of the practical stuff sort of follows after that.
Well, I think maybe we want to wrap up our discussion for today. I thought this was very helpful, though, to kind of delve into this. And obviously, it's a complex project. I wonder if it would be worthwhile. What's our meeting?
Next Wednesday. Next Wednesday. Yeah, the 12th.
The 12th. And that might be good, but we have
have some things that couldn't be done today. So
I'm just wondering if it would be helpful to kind of take some of the discussion we've had today and have to get down on paper maybe some a working definition of affordability, and then we can kind of move from there. Maybe at our next meeting, depending on how, or maybe at the following meeting, and we can kind of start to build off of that.
Sure.
Does that make sense for people?
Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
What? Oh, if people have ideas and want to submit them to Jen, I think. Does everybody have your email address? Or, yeah. Or Shannon. Or to both, perhaps. That might be good. About how you would define affordability and any other comments you have about the discussion today. And then we can go forward. Well, thank you, everybody. I thought this was a good discussion.
Yeah.
So we'll be adjourned.